This is Richard Verone, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. Charles Hubbs. Today is January 27th, 2003. It is approximately 9:33 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I am in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library in the interview room. And Mr. Hubbs, you are in Shalimar, Florida.
Right.
Sir, if we could begin with some biographical information on yourself, could you tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
I was born in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
On 1 October 1930, I'm sorry, that's 5 October 1930.
Okay.
And when I was not more than maybe a month or two old,
mm-hmm.
my folks moved to New Jersey, and I spent the rest of my years up to my teenage years, including high school, in New Jersey in a town called Belford, B-E-L-F-O-R-D.
Belford. Okay.
Yeah, it's on the border. It's on the waterfront there,
mm-hmm.
on Sandy Hook Bay. And it's a little fishing town.
Okay.
And let me see. I think my father finished sixth grade. My mother finished secretarial school.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, when I was very young, we were on welfare,
mm-hmm.
poor as church mice. And my dad was a fisherman, and he made $1 a day, and he spent about $1.10 on booze.
Okay.
And he got run over by a car when I was about 6 years old, and he never had another drink again. Best thing that ever happened to him.
That sobered him up.
Yeah, it probably saved his liver, too.
Really?
And anyway, things turned around for us dramatically after that.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents do for a living?
Okay, my dad was a fisherman. He worked on commercial fishing boats. He was getting $1 a day on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother went to work for the people that hand out cheese and those things. I can't think of the name of the organization, but it was for poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And got hired on there because she was such an industrious person. And as a result, she spent the next 32 years as the assistant. What the hell would you call it here? assistant township clerk.
Okay.
Which was a pretty big deal in that little township.
Mm-hmm.
And very political. And in the meantime, I went to high school, and what was then Middletown Township High School.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I went, and I had an appointment to Annapolis, which was politically gained by my mother, and I turned it down. And I went to Muhlenberg College
mm-hmm.
in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and proceeded to immediately flunk out. Although I'd had great grades in high school, but I found girls and beer all the same time.
Okay. Before we get into your college years, tell me a little bit about your high school years, and what are your best memories of those years? Do you remember, first of all, growing up young with the Depression and World War II?
Oh, boy, do I ever.
What do you remember about that?
Well, we were poor. We didn't have anything. We didn't have much. Well, we were just starting to come out of the woods then.
Mm-hmm.
I think we actually got indoor plumbing during that period.
Okay.
During my latter 8 or 10 or 12 year old time, I can't remember exactly when. But we got indoor plumbing, and we got another house.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm trying to think. Well, I don't know. That's about it. Yeah. We were getting better off, you know, all the time.
Okay. What are your memories of World War II?
The thing that I guess made me want to go into service was I saw a picture in one of the photojournalists or something of a guy by the name of Captain Art Wehner
mm-hmm.
standing on some sandbags in Iwo Jima, I think, with a Thompson submachine gun in each hand.
Okay.
And I don't know why that picture stays with me to this day.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That did it. I said, oh, I got to be that guy. Get right out there and shoot all them big guns and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I went from there to, in high school, I met the cheerleader, the head of the cheerleaders, and that immediately caused me all kinds of grief because I fell madly in love with her. And I was the captain of the football team,
mm-hmm.
quarterback. What all that meant, and we never won a championship, so that didn't fit into it.
What kind of student were you?
high school, I was a good one. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say I sure went that pot. When I turned to college, I didn't even know how to use a library. It was still love. And I wasn't fitted out for college at that time.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
No, I was a single one.
Okay.
And the only sibling. But the Korean War is what got me started, I think. That'd be the best jump I could make to it.
Mm-hmm.
I flunked out of Muhlenberg, and I got my mother pulled some strings and got me back in for my sophomore year.
Mm-hmm.
And I flunked out again.
Did you really?
Oh, it was beautiful. I was such a wonderful student.
What was it? Was it just a lack of concentration on academics, or?
Oh hell no! I was into girls and beer.
Okay.
And I had no time for college at all. Even though I was in college, I mm-hmm. didn't spend much time there.
Mm-hmm. What years was this?
This was let's see. I got out of high school in 1948, so it had been 1949 to 1950.
Okay.
The Korean War broke out. I immediately enlisted signed up. You don't go in right away in those days. Mm-hmm. I signed up for the Air Force in August, I think, of 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And but I didn't get to go in until February as an enlisted man.
Okay.
And then I went to Simpson Air Force Base, yeah,
mm-hmm.
up in New York. And instead, when I graduated from basic training, mm-hmm. they kept me on, and I was what was called a tech instructor. But I wasn't the kind that went hopping up 2, 3, 4 down the street. I was in this train station meeting inbound recruits.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would park them on a bus and load them all out to the base, and the sergeants there would take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, the Air Force was starting to hurt really bad for pilots. They dropped the requirements for entry into pilot school from a college degree down to 2 years of college, and then even less.
Mm-hmm.
But it was only open for a 3-month window.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a good squadron commander. He liked my hustle. He put me in for it. I got it. And just as soon as I got it, the 400 of us that were selected for pilot school were then reselected involuntarily go to Radar Observer School because the F-94 two-seater interceptor was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a radar observer. Well, I was fit to be tied. But they said 13 months and then we'll put you back in pilot school. And they stuck to their word.
Uh-huh.
So I spent 13 months in the 2nd Fighter Squadron and the 3rd, 5th Fighter Squadron at McGuire.
What made you choose the Air Force versus another branch of the service?
Well, I had that deal with the Navy, but I turned it down. I wanted to fly.
Uh-huh. And why did you turn down your appointment to Annapolis?
I wasn't ready for it. It's a good thing I didn't go. Can you imagine me trying to do something with that group the way I flunked out of college?
Uh-huh.
No, I wasn't ready for anything like that.
What prompted you to want to fly?
I had a friend of mine. We were pretty adventurous. One day we drove over to the Red Bank Airport,
mm-hmm.
and we paid $5 a piece
mm-hmm.
to get into an old Stearman. But we were sitting in the back, or maybe we were in the front, I don't know. And this guy took us up for maybe 10 or 15 minutes and did some loops and twirls and came back down. I said, that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's simple.
Mm-hmm. So, but, go ahead.
No, that's okay. From there, I went to I don't know where I was at.
Well, tell me about Samson. What was your basic training like for you?
I don't know. I liked it. You know, it was probably the first time I really gotten regimented and, you know, given some, had to follow the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of turned me around. I was kind of a worthless sort of soul.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a bad kid. It's just that I didn't have any idea about, conformity.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed it. So then, when I got into the cadets, which was pretty strict,
mm-hmm.
the radar observer cadets, that was aviation cadets. I was in that for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I came out with a second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And I thought, boy, I went from $83 a month to $483 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, man, this is for me. I like this business.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to go to Korea. That was my whole deal. I wanted to go fight the war.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you want to get into the actual combat zone?
Oh, man, that's what it's all about, you know. Uh-huh. And if you're in the service, that's what you got to be doing.
Okay.
So I volunteered in Radar Observer School for Korea. Mm-hmm. And where did they send me? McGuire Air Force Base, New Jersey, 20 miles from home. Mm-hmm. Last thing in the world I wanted. Mm-hmm. So I missed the Korean War. I was 13 months as a cadet, as a radar observer. Mm-hmm. Went back to pilot school at the end of that and graduated just as soon as I graduated, the Koreans gave up. They knew I was coming. So I got an assignment to Germany, uh-huh. And that was a great assignment. That was really something else.
What year was this?
54.
Okay.
Yeah.
How supportive were your parents about your military career?
Well, they thought it was great because I'd finally gotten to be somebody. Uh-huh. You know, I wasn't a ne'er-do-well, just uh-huh. putting their money away. Uh-huh. I quit spending their money for a change, and they were getting nothing back for it. Uh-huh. So that worked out well. They were proud of me. Uh-huh. My dad had been a corporal in World War I, So he thought that was neat that I got to be an officer.
Okay. How did you take to flying? Tell me what that was, that experience.
Well, as a radar observer, you're riding the back end of an F-94, uh-huh. which is a jet. Fighter, so I had about 350 hours in the back end of an F-94, and all the guys I flew with, the pilots up front, were all returnees from Korea, mm-hmm. so they were hot dogs, and man, they really put those birds through their paces. Mm-hmm. Well, by the time I got to flying school, I was just about ready for first lieutenant, and so that made me pretty senior. I also had a set of wings, and I had this 350 hours in jet fighters. Mm-hmm. So I went through flying school like a dose of salts. I mean, I took to that like there was no end to it. Mm-hmm. Except that I was in the front of the airplane and not in the back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that was great. You know, that was really neat.
Did it come natural to you, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no problem at all. Never scratched an airplane in 26 years of flying.
Okay. So when you got to your assignment in Germany, what was exactly your assignment there? What were you doing?
Well, the Germans had been, by the treaties after the war, were not allowed to have any armies or air force. So now they were getting relaxed, and they were going to, the powers that be were going to allow them to have an air force. Mm-hmm. So here I was, I probably had 120 hours total time, and I'm now an instructor pilot in the new German Air Force.
Okay.
And I'm going to teach these guys how to fly.
How did you feel about that, teaching the Germans?
It was ridiculous, because some of them had 4,000 combat hours.
Uh-huh.
You know, some of them had bailed out half a dozen times. Some of them had shot down, I don't know how many American airplanes.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to teach them how to fly. So it was. I learned a lot from them, let's put it that way.
Well, tell me what you learned. What did you think you learned?
Oh, they were great pilots.
Yeah?
Yeah. The old ones, the ones from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're talking Eric Hartman and Barth and all kinds of fantastic, great aces. So that group went through, and then when they went through, they were supposed to then turn around and train younger Germans, new Germans, mm-hmm. Non-flyers yet. And so we got some of those, and that was a rather interesting thing because they didn't speak any English.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the end of that.
How did you communicate?
Not very well.
Yeah.
Not very well, no. A lot of it was shake the stick,
uh-huh.
yell. uh-huh. And they knew. They would say, no, or nine, you know. And they said, oh, that's not what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But a great number of them could speak very good English.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them couldn't speak any. And we were learning German at the same time they were learning English.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of give and take. And there's one word in the aeronautical dictionary that's called Vergasseheizung.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you've probably never heard it, and I never had either.
Mm-hmm.
But I took off with the first German to fly legally after World War II at a training field called Landsberg in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I took off with him. It's in a T-6 propeller airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It got about 4,000 feet over the field. And before I took off, I pointed to the de-ice carburetor ice. And I said, do you know what this is, carburetor ice? He said, yeah, you know. So we take off, get up about 4,000 feet. The engine quits, full of carburetor ice. So we start gliding down, and I keep saying to him, regardless of height, son? He says, no, I mean, I'm saying to him, carburetor ice. He says, yeah. All the way to touchdown. We landed on the same runway. No problem. But anyway, when I got to the parking place, where I just rolled it to, the crew chief came out, and I said to him, you speak both English and German. What in the heck's the word for carburetor ice? Or carburetor heat, I shouldn't say ice, carburetor heat. And he said, for Gaza Heizung. So I wrote it on my checklist. I never had a problem again with that. That's the first time I'd ever heard that word. But he didn't know what the heck carburetor heat was, and he wasn't going to admit he didn't either. But anyway, a few scrapes like that. But after that, we got along so well with the Germans. They were so polite to us. They were good pilots. Boy, they were good.
How long did you stay in Germany?
3 years.
Until 1957?
Yeah, 57, yeah.
57, okay. And from where there did you go?
I went from there to Jet Ferry Squadron, which I wanted, which was an outfit that was ferrying F-100s. They were just coming out of the rack then, and they were flying them to Europe. Mm-hmm. And I got there, and all the choice flights were taken by the older guys there. Mm-hmm. And what was left was, I guess it was the CIA, I don't know. It had to have been the CIA. It was giving away old fighters, F-80s, to a lot of people in South America. Mm-hmm. And they had all kinds of funny little airfields down here that were all camouflaged. You couldn't even find them. But anyway, so what do I catch? I catch what the other operation, 100's going to Europe with high flight. I caught low flight going to South America. So I took F-80s to South America. And while I was down there on one of the trips, they closed the squadron.
Okay.
Just flat deactivated that sucker while I was down there. Uh-huh. And the guys in the squadron had a nice party on me, charged to my club bill. Mm-hmm. But I was okay, it didn't bother me. And so I came back, and I found out I'd been assigned to Donelson Air Force Base, C-124's Military Airlift Command. Mm-hmm. Well, for a guy who'd been nothing but single engine all his life, that wasn't going to go too well with me.
Why did they switch you from that to
because
different planes?
We were having so many accidents in the ferry command, and that was under TAC at the time. The TAC said, we're not going to have this anymore, and they gave it all to Military Airlift Command.
Okay.
But Military Airlift Command didn't have any jets, didn't have any single engine planes. It just had four-engine, big old lumbering mother's C-124s.
Mm-hmm.
So I made captain on my way between bases. I got promoted between bases.
How long were you doing the F-80s to South America?
Not very long.
Really?
Because I got back in '57, mid-'57. Mm-hmm. And I was in mid-'58, I was in Donelson Air Force Base.
Okay.
So about a year, that's all.
Okay.
And I went to Donelson. Now I had brand new captain bars pinned on.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, I went in, personnel guy, and he and I didn't get along too well, but that was all right. He said, you're going over as a co-pilot in a C-124. And I said, I don't think so. And he said, ask me, Captain. Who's a major?
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I just went down the hall and looked around. I finally found a general's office.
Mm-hmm.
There was a general by the name of Wade Hampton. And his exec was a Major Pinson.
Mm-hmm.
I went in and I said to Major Pinson, I said, I'd like to see the general. And he kind of looked at me like, you know, do captains walk in like that very often?
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty tenacious about it. I said, I'm not ferocious here. I just want to talk to him. So he said, well, I'll see. So he stuck his head in the door, and he says, come on. So I went in, and there's one star there, the first one I'd ever met.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I don't want to throw my wings on the counter here, because I don't want to quit flying, but I sure don't want to fly C-124s. Well, he pops up out of his chair, and he said, let me tell you something. He said, in World War II, I was flying Mustangs. He said, I don't want to fly them either. He said, why don't you go back to your base, your personnel officer? Well, by the time I got there, Pinson had called this personnel guy, and he was really ticked off. Mm-hmm. So he said, I'll fix you. And he did. He made me an assistant adjutant to a bird colonel, non-rated, maintenance type, that hated officers.
Oh, gosh.
The guy didn't have any officers working for him. He had nothing but super NCOs. Mm-hmm. And his name was Floyd Johnson. Hell of a nice guy, but boy, was he tough on the... He was an old line guy, you know, a really old typer. Mm-hmm. Well, I lasted over there. I tried to out get to work earlier than him, which impressed him a little bit. Finally, I went in one morning, 4 a.m., and he was still there, or he was in there, he just come in. I said, okay, I give up. He says, I hope you will. He says, I'm getting tired of trying to beat you. And he said, I don't like officers, you know that. I said, yeah, I know. He said, go over to base operations and hang around there with your fly buddies and don't bother me anymore. I said, fair enough to me, because I didn't know a damn thing about being an assistant adjutant. Mm-hmm. So I went over to base ops, and I caught rides with guys passing through. So I was still current in jet aircraft. Mm-hmm. About 3 or 4 months later.
Okay.
And
you were flying them, or you actually were in the back seat, or?
Well, I could fly them because I was a pilot. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of guys that come through in an empty seat. They'd say, "Oh, come on, let's go." Mm-hmm. So I'd go with them, and I'd have to hitchhike my way back somehow. But it didn't matter. I didn't have a job anyway on base. Mm-hmm. So it was up to me to get some flying time. But what it was, man, I kept myself current in the air in the P-33. Mm-hmm. So I that was fine. I get a phone call one day, and it's from Major Pinson, and he said, "Charlie, you still got your flying gear in the back of that 57 Thunderbird of yours?" I said, "Oh, sure." He says, "Okay." He says, "Meet me at base ops in about 30 minutes." I said, "Okay." So I did. He says, "Get your gear." We jump on a C-47. He flies me to Shaw Air Force Base. He lets me off. He said, "All right, you go in there, bail out the paperwork, and jump in that T-33 and bring it to Donelson. Mm-hmm. It'll be the first jet coming into Military Airlift Command." I said, "Ooh, that's interesting." He said, "But I'm going to be on the ground with the props turning. You're going to jump in and go back, and we'll pick up another one." So I brought two T-33s into Donelson Air Force Base. They were the first jets that MAC ever had, or MATS, whatever they want to call them in those days. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Okay." In the meantime, I meet my red-headed nurse and married her 6 weeks later. Mm-hmm. She was pretty nice young lady, second lieutenant. So as soon as I get the two jets in there, and I'm flying them around all the time, having a grand time, the call from MAC headquarters, and they say, "We want you up here overnight." I said, "Whoa, I'm married. I don't know." I was able to get Beth out of the service. Mm-hmm. Discharged. Out. Finny. And overnight. And she accompanied me to match, and they were setting up that none of their super pilots had colonel and general rank officers had ever flown jets. That was our job. There were several of us picked, and we got to set up a jet checkout program.
Where was this again?
Scott Air Force Base, headquarters of MATS Air Force.
Okay.
MATS, yeah.
What year was this? Do you remember?
Yeah, 58.
Okay.
Yep. And so that's where I spent the next 3 years. Uh-huh. And I must have done a good job checking out colonels, because they're all hammering on me. Got to go to college. Got to get a college degree. Uh-huh. I'm having a good time flying. Said, no, you got to go. So the next thing I know, boy, I got to take a raft of tests and a whole bunch of stuff. And I wind up going to the University of Chicago. Remember, I only have two years of college. And then they're flunking years, you know. They're not
right.
Good years.
Right.
I go up there, and I'm in the graduate program. Boy, was that a shock. I went from completely illiterate to double illiterate at that point.
What kind of program, graduate program, was it?
Oh, it was MBA and Associate R&D Management. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I didn't know how to use the library. So the first year, I had 1 year to do all this. So the first 3 months, I had 2 D's and a C or something. It was pretty poor.
Mm-hmm.
By then, I learned how to use the library. That helped.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one, I went 3 C's. And then the next time, which was when the ninth month, I had about 3 B's. And then the final one, I couldn't quite make it because I had no undergraduates. I had to take a whole bunch of funny little courses, undergrad courses. And I couldn't take them and get through it all in a year.
Mm-hmm.
So the Air Force actually took pity on me, and they gave me another 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had a ball after that. I didn't have to take any of the undergraduate stuff because each one of those professors took one look at me. Remember, I'm up there in a burqa, and high and tight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hippie year.
Mm-hmm.
And the University of Chicago is definitely not a good place for a military person to be.
Right.
They were spitting on everybody. They were having a tough, you know, want to kill the president, blah, 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 blah. So, okay. So I went through the drill, and then the props also said, we're going to give you a comp exam. I said, okay. And like one of them said, you know, who's Plato? I said, I don't know. Is he Greek or why? He said, that's good. You passed. He gave me a D.
Okay.
So they gave me D's for all those courses I didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And they cleared that up. And so when I graduated, which was 6 months late, I got an S on one of my grades instead of a letter.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd gotten a letter, I'd have been on the dean's list.
Hmm.
I mean, that's pretty damn good for a guy to know what the hell he was doing when he walked in the door.
Was this in 1962,
63?
63.
And I never did get an undergraduate degree in all the years afterwards.
Okay.
So I still got an MBA and all that other.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, tell me about the Cuban Missile Crisis. What were your thoughts on that?
That was funny. They were scattering B-52s all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all over the country. B-47s, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everybody in the block that we lived, we lived in an apartment off base. It was a U, big U, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, everybody knew I was an Air Force guy, but they'd never seen me in anything. Well, I had my uniform hanging on the door of the closet, and I had a Mauser that I was rehabbing rifle.
Mm-hmm.
So here I got this Mauser rifle out on the kitchen table, on a sheet. My uniform's hanging on the door, and one of the neighbors came in, turned right around, screaming right out the door, "We're going to war!" And next thing you know, I got the whole damn court over in my kitchen, trying to find out what time the war starts.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to invade Cuba, and they thought I was going to do it. I said, I'm still in school. I said, this stuff I wear when I go down to Scott Field to go to something.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only reason. It was really hilarious in a way.
Mm-hmm.
They panicked. Jeez, they went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, where'd I go from there? Scott Field. Oh. I went to Patrick Air Force Base, Central Control, Cape Canaveral.
Okay.
That was a good job.
This is in 1963 or 64?
Yeah,
63.
That was neat. I was a young captain, and I had a hell of a lot of responsibility. I could
mm-hmm.
blow up anything taken off, you know, firing out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was right there in the middle of the Polaris program and all that, and the first astronauts. It was all really. It was wonderful. That's all I say. It's a great experience.
What were your duties there?
I was a range controller in central control,
mm-hmm.
and I had my own console with little 2 buttons on. I could blow up anything I didn't like. I never did, but because we had range safety guys that had a better shot at it than me.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had the option to do it if I wanted to.
So central control, as in the space program, central control.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, this was top of the line, big dog stuff.
Uh-huh.
And really enjoyable. And I was on call the entire time I was there,
mm-hmm.
day, night, whatever. When I went to the officers' club, which was frequently, practically every day,
mm-hmm.
with my wife, I would take off my hat and put it on the cashier's table or whatever you want to call it. And my hat was there, I was there, and they had to come find me if I got a phone call, if I didn't answer it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat wasn't there, I wasn't there. Then he knew to call the house. Mm-hmm. It was rather a unique thing. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun, and it was a great time, and that was good. Then I got to fly in a 104. Mm-hmm. And that was my dream. My buddy, a guy by the name of John Kimmerly, he had the 104 detachment that was assigned up there, and he finally let me fly his 104 if I would go to Vietnam with him. So I signed up for F-105s, and he signed up for 105s, and we waited. His orders came through a ground job in Saigon. He was so mad, he said, I'm going to quit the Air Force the minute I finish this tour. And he did. They lost one of the best pilots they ever had by that. I don't know what the hell they were thinking of. And my 105 assignment, which was a fighter, you know, F-105, mm-hmm. dropped big bombs up north, turned out to be, the guy told me over the phone, he says, this is the guy from personnel. He said, well, Charlie, he says, you can go for your choice here, the 105. He said, it'll be 18 months before you go, and you'll go as Blue 13. You'll be so far down the chain of command, you wouldn't believe it. Or, he said, I can send you this week as a commander of a flying outfit. I said, holy moly, try me. Mm-hmm. Sure. Guess what? C-123's defoliation.
That's what, and that was your immediate assignment.
That's what it was. That was my whole assignment the whole time I was
there. And this is what year?
60, let's see. This was 65.
65.
But I didn't get to go. I had to go through cold weather school up at Fairchild, mm-hmm. which was ridiculous. Go from Florida to Fairchild and freeze my butt off and then go to Southeast Asia.
How long were you in cold weather school?
It only lasted about, I think it was 3 weeks.
Okay. How much had you kept up with American foreign policy and what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia?
You know, I didn't even care about it in those days.
Really?
No. I didn't care about it until about the end of the war.
So you really didn't, did you understand what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam at this point?
Hell no. All I knew was I got a chance to get in combat. You know, I've got to go to combat. You know, there's no way around it.
Right.
And that's what it's all about. Well, I got my fill of that, and I don't have that attitude anymore. Mm-hmm. But
how did you get over to Vietnam? Did you fly commercial civilian air out of off the West Coast, or what?
I'm trying to think. Yeah, I guess I did. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. Yeah, I believe I went over commercial.
So you, at this point, you felt that you were simply wanted to get into combat, and that was your goal.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to defend the United States. Uh-huh. Well, I'm going to help out those poor, whoever, South Vietnamese. I wasn't even didn't even know who the hell they were at the time. Mm-hmm. And even though I have a master's degree, you know, I'm still naive about all this political stuff at this point. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, we've got to do this. This will enhance my career, and I get to fly combat and test myself. typical macho young. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I got to Clark Air Force Base, and I was supposed to go through snake school there, which is a jungle school. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting smarter as I go along here. So I call up on the payphone. I call the sergeant in charge of snake school, and I said, has Major Hubs checked in yet? And he gave me a long, involved thing that went, I don't know who the hell's here. I don't know who's been here. I don't know who's coming here, and I don't care. I'm busy. Bing! And hang up the phone. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, that sounds like I shouldn't give them any more trouble than what they have now. I went over and got on the next airplane to go to the war.
So you skipped it.
I passed it up. Why? What the hell I need snake school for? I was going to go up there and fly missions. And I did. And I flew more ranch hand missions than any other guy for a one-year tour.
Mm-hmm. Where did you land when you got into Vietnam?
Well, I was supposed to land Thanh Son Nhut. That's where my head was, but I wound up in Ben Hoa.
Okay.
And that wasn't the right answer. So they lied to me about where that airplane was going.
Right.
And I finally, early in the morning, I got a chopper flight back to Thanh Son Nhut. By the name of Ralph Dresser, who was the major in charge of the ranch at that time, who I was replacing, met me on his motorcycle, mm-hmm. took me down the flight line, and put me in an airplane and we went and flew my first mission.
That
an hour after I was on the ground.
Wow. And so you've been in country, what, 48 hours?
Well, yeah, counting Benoit.
Uh-huh.
But that wasn't where I was supposed to be. That was just wasted time over there.
What was your impression of Vietnam when you first got into the country?
Dirty.
Yeah.
That was a dirty country.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you couldn't trust anybody. Remember in 66, we all carried guns all the time, downtown or anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We were, because they were still throwing hand grenades at us and,
mm-hmm.
and the buses and things. Everything was chicken wired.
So you were based at Tonsonut the whole time?
I'm sorry?
You were based at Tonsonut in Saigon the whole time?
No, that was just the beginning.
Okay, how long were you there?
Probably about 2 or 3 months at the most.
Okay.
And I know that by the end of the first week, I had 10 combat missions. I had an air medal, a Purple Heart, and a DFC.
After the first week?
First week.
Tell me about that week. What happened?
Ralph was a. He said, Charlie, he said, I want to go home, and you're going to be a quick learn. He says, watch this. He started me in the right seat of the number three. We flew the flight of threes in the number three airplane. That first, that was the first day I was in. I sat in the middle the first time. Didn't do anything. Second flight, I was in the right seat of the third plane. In the next flight, next day, I was in the left seat of the third airplane. The next day, I was in the right seat. And then the next mission, I was in the right seat of the second airplane. But you know what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
I hoppy jumped all the way up. By the end of the week, I was flight lead. I was the commander to be in the flight lead all in less than a week.
Tell me about your first mission. What was your impression of what was going on?
Well, I didn't know what the hell was going on. I didn't have a clue.
Yeah? Did you understand that you were spraying defoliants and...
Oh, yes. Well, we practiced that in the States where I went.
Okay.
I had a one-month course over in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
Langley,
mm-hmm.
on spray techniques, but we didn't spray anything but water.
Mm-hmm.
But we did spray, but it was for practice. And then, where are we at? We got the... anyway, Ralph got transferred out, and I remember now I went over to be the commander.
Uh-huh.
And as an aside, when I left, 1 year later, I was number 13 in the chain of command, and I never had got to be the commander.
Hmm. What? Now, how did that work out?
Because every cotton picking lieutenant colonel in the Air Force wanted a piece of this action because it was a good step up in the... Get a good ER and get promoted.
Uh-huh.
It was really funny. Poor young major didn't have a prayer.
Okay. Well, tell me, how did you get your air medal and your Purple Heart that first week?
Getting shot at.
Yeah?
Yeah. We took a lot of hits. At one point, John Hart did a 6-minute interview with me on Walter Cronkite's show.
Mm-hmm.
He spent 10 days with us. And in it, if you'd listened to him, you had me. I was the, what do you call it? I was the most, I was the leader of the whole damn world, or the Air Force at least, in Vietnam. Of course I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But he did say I was the world's most shot at and hit commander. And that stuck.
Yeah?
Yeah. So I wasn't either, because there's a lot of Army guys, Army dust off guys that deserve that.
Mm-hmm.
See?
What was it like your first time being shot at in combat?
Jesus, scared the hell out of me.
Yeah? Small arms fire from the ground?
Oh, yeah. Well, we only flew at 100 feet.
Right.
And these guys, that way, somebody before I got there came back with an arrow stuck in his airplane. So I don't know about that one. I didn't see that, but I know we could hear. I heard every round fired that ever went into my airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I tell you about the first part, the first mission, the first week,
mm-hmm.
I'm flying with Ralph. And he's a big guy. He was like an All-American with the University of Texas, football player.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in the right seat, and I'm in the left seat. Yeah, we're leading. I'm the super guy this time. And, boy, we took one in the cockpit, and I heard it hit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd never heard a bullet hit a person before, but I knew that hit him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was dead. So I'm hanging on for dear life.
Where did it hit him?
It hit him in the arm. But I didn't know that at the time. So I finally, kind of shaky, like I put you on the button, and I said, Ralph? But, are you all right? Yeah, of course I'm all right. Hang in there and get your goddamn stuff together, okay? So I looked over at him, and he's got a Bowie knife out. I mean, like Jim Bowie Cook,
mm-hmm.
that big. And he's picking shrapnel and stuff out of his arm. I almost threw up. That bothered me more than the bullets coming in the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he was just quite a guy.
How did you get wounded?
It was minor. Just a bullet through a hydraulic line or something. I don't know.
And then it hit you?
A face full of crap, yeah.
Oh, shrapnel that hit you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Minor. I didn't even lose a thing off it. No scars. No big deals.
Mm-hmm.
Sure helped when I got out of the service, though. Having a Purple Heart.
Okay, so that was your first week. Tell me about how effective you think the defoliant spraying was.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We could go back 6 weeks after we sprayed a particular area and it was barren. And we did the roads. For the first couple of months I was there, all we did was the roads.
Mm-hmm.
The trails, I'm sorry. No, they weren't roads, they were trails. And boy, did we open those things up. And that was amazing. And they had... they had trails that they pulled the foliage and stuff right over the top and made tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
So you never would have seen them from the air, ever. And they were just like highways.
Mm-hmm.
And they used bulldozers. They had everything down there.
Mm-hmm.
If we saw a bulldozer, we called in. The Air Force would come and blow the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm. How often would you spray a particular area?
Well, like I say, it took 6 weeks for it to... be totally effective.
Mm-hmm.
We flew three aircraft minimum every time, never less than three.
Mm-hmm.
And we only had three when I first started. We had 26 or so when I left, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, three aircraft, twice a day, every day. And I went about 36 days straight one time. And the youngsters caught me going out the door to... I just briefed the mission, and I was going out the door to get on the airplane, get on the flight line. They lifted me up under the armpits, took all my fighting gear off me, handed me a little ditty bag and $400, and said, "Bingo, here's your airplane." They put me on a C-121 going up to Taipei. I was getting squirrely. And it was just as well. You could only go so long flying in combat. You'd get a little weird.
Right.
Yeah.
What was your typical day like?
Get up 4 o'clock in the morning, eat a lousy meal, and sometimes just pass it up and go get a C-ration out of it. We always carried C-rations in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I probably ate about 100 cases of C-rations. I loved them.
Mm-hmm.
But then down to the flight line, and brief. We get the intelligence briefing, and,
mm-hmm.
and we would brief ourselves. And, but it got to be so, you know, mundane in the later months. I'll go down there, I'll go down, climb in the airplane, come do it.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much laid back.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't even use checklists. One guy did. Bob Eichelman, he always used a checklist.
For the airplane, you mean?
Yeah. We never did. I never did. I hated flying with Bob. He made me use a checklist.
Uh-huh.
I had to go hunt for mine. I never knew where it was. But anyway, we would take off. And most of our targets were within an hour of our base. Now, remember, we started it in Tatsunu,
mm-hmm.
and then we always had something going up at Da Nang, and I spent the biggest part of my tour at Da Nang.
Okay.
And that's the only way I could keep my flight together and not lose it to some lieutenant colonel that just popped on board.
Mm-hmm.
None of them wanted to fly in the mountains, so I was safe up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there until the last week of my tour.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you go out and fly your mission. Who determined exactly what area you would be spraying?
Oh, Jesus, what a joke that was. Saigon did all this,
mm-hmm.
the planning, right?
Mm-hmm.
The only trouble was, it was so insecure, all that information, that they always knew when we were coming.
Really?
So when we got up to Da Nang, I was ahead of Sea Flight, and their famous Sea Flight is the most famous flight in all of the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they said, Pete Spivey, the navigator, said, "Charlie, there is no sense in us doing this the way we're doing it. They've got our number." I said, "Okay, what do you want to do?" He said, "We're going to make up a tertiary target. You know, we have a primary target, we have a secondary target. That comes from Saigon. We're going to make a tertiary target, and that comes from us. We don't tell Saigon about it.
Hmm.
And so they would take, we would go and we cut our shot hits, our hits down 50% by doing that.
Really?
Sure. Yeah. They got in. The VC knew more about us than we knew about ourselves.
How did they find this out?
Oh, first of all, they had all their spies were in the chain of command. VC. But they also had all of our communications had been tapped.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have any of that fancy stuff, you know, that they have today. So we were sending it in the clear, and they just read it in the clear and said, oh, well, guess where they're going to be tomorrow? Antelope Valley. Set up a lot of anti-aircraft stuff there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you, from Saigon, you were there for 2 or 3 months, and you went to Da Nang, and at Da Nang you stayed the rest of your tour?
I stayed at Da Nang as long as I possibly could.
And why was that again?
Every time I told you there were so many lieutenant colonels came in,
mm-hmm.
and they were taking over all the spots that had anything to do with getting a title.
Mm-hmm.
Well, flight commander's a good title to have in Vietnam. Well, okay, so I kept my flight up there, and they tried one time to send a guy over to take over the flight. And I don't know who engineered this, but I assume it was the guys in the flight.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you're staying home tomorrow. We're taking this guy on the flight, and he's, quote, about to be new flight commander, and we want to indoctrinate him. And they picked the hottest target they could find and went in and did everything wrong to get shot at, and intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
The guy never came. He got back. He went to Saigon. He said, give me trash haulers. I want to go to C-124s. They're not in the ranch yet. I got my flight back.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty proud of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
We're still sticking together, you know.
Yeah.
We have a reunion every year.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Air Force study, the physical study came up, we go as a flight. We all, the C flight goes together,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty neat.
So once you're up in the air, tell me exactly how you would go about spraying and just kind of describe that.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. Huh? Because what we'd like to do, we always have to spray early in the morning because the wind is a detriment to spray. If you spray in a high wind, it just goes straight up in the air.
Right.
You might just well have stayed home. So we want to go in on calm weather. Got to be able to see, so no fog. But we try to come in with the sun behind us. And we get out, and we would orbit at 3,500 feet, and we would orbit at 2,500, let's say. The FAC would be at 1,500, and the fighters would be at 3,500.
Okay.
When we all got together and got everything organized, and we would start down, and we would go straight down, well, right on a red line,
mm-hmm.
pull out treetop level, and go streaming in across the target. And the fighters would be right out there shooting the daylights out of everything ahead of us. And the FAC would be up there telling everybody how good we were doing. But that's what it was. It only took one pass, usually, because we only had 4 minutes to spray.
How much?
10,000 gallons.
10,000 gallons per
we
airplane.
Sure put it out.
Yeah. And you would go down one at a time, or would all three?
No, formation.
Go down.
Always in formation.
Three at a time.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, you didn't want to give them two chances to shoot at you.
Right. Were you shot at almost every mission, or
almost every mission? And it was interesting because when I first got there, the first bunch of hits we took were in the tail of the third airplane.
Uh-huh.
That's the last airplane back. By the time I left, they were hitting in the cockpit of the first airplane. So those gunners had gotten some training somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's when they started hurting us.
Well, it sounds like they improved their accuracy
exponentially. Yeah, they really did. We took some bad hits too when they started coming up front.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever lose any men?
Oh yeah, we lost 28 guys while we were over there.
In your flight?
No, not in my flight, but a guy who had just left my flight got killed.
Yeah.
A guy named Roy Kubley was my mentor. He was a captain and I was a major, but he was still the best I ever met over there,
mm-hmm.
and he was good. And he brought me up a little bit to speed, and then he went over to B flight, and they turned a corner up there, and a Quad 50 just blew him out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. And, that wasn't too good. But we had an interesting guy's name to be withheld, fell in love with a Vietnamese lady.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got himself an apartment for her, or a hooch downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got her a motorcycle, and then he went to Da Nang. But in the meantime, her mother and father moved in with her, so he had to buy two more motorcycles. And then other siblings who were questionable were moving in, so he's buying my motorcycles for them, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he came home from the... I left that part here. So when we were flying, I switched the lead all the time, let everybody else get some of the action. If he was flying, he never would call for fire ahead of us, airstrikes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was getting the rest of us shot up, and we didn't like it. You saw all those nice Vietnamese people, blah, 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 blah. So he came home early from Da Nang one time, and here's his girlfriend having a big time with about three bikers in the sack, you know.
Three Americans or
no.
Vietnamese. Okay.
Yeah. And so next time I flew with him, he said, we're just taking off. And he said, free fire zone, fire, strike, kill all of them. You talk about a personality change. Wow. So, he was a nice guy, but he didn't have much sense. Okay, now say, you want to know how we did it in the air? Okay. We always had fighters, and that's it. Let me give you that point right now before I get into this too far. Everybody says, oh my God, those poor GIs are getting drenched in Agent Orange.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you straight out, as a commander, in Vietnam, we never sprayed Agent Orange ever on an American troop or any friendly troop.
Mm-hmm.
Reason being, and take this school with you, when we came in on those passes, we had free strike zone wherever we went,
mm-hmm.
and we had three, minimum, sometimes four, fighters shooting up the ground ahead of us,
mm-hmm.
blowing it away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you think we'd be doing that with Americans down there? No, we weren't allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever we were doing it and shooting, there wasn't any Americans.
Okay.
So I want to meet these guys that had it dripping off them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're putting out 3 gallons per acre. Do you know how much that, and only 6% of it gets to the ground?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's ridiculous. I don't know where these guys are coming
from. So the claims of the infantry saying...
Well, only those claims that say we were dripping in it, they sprayed it all over us.
Right.
That's much bull. I'm not going to say they probably didn't puddle on the ground somewhere. Maybe they stepped in.
Sure.
And there's a lot of ways they could have done it. One way was the Army came and got 50-gallon drums of it from us and then sprayed around their tents and underneath their cots.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder they got sick.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to do that. That stuff was miserable. It ate your shoes up in 3 months. You'd wear out of your shoes would fall apart in 3 months from
mm-hmm.
Anyway, now, we did one thing that these guys saw, and I would back up and agree with them.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the malaria control bird.
Okay.
We flew it over every installation in South Vietnam, and we sprayed over every installation in South Vietnam at least once a week.
Mm-hmm.
It was a silver airplane. It was not a camouflaged airplane, and it just pushed out. Malathion.
Right.
Drug spray.
Mm-hmm.
And that we did. And they were out there eating lunch when we sprayed over them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I can see where they say, oh my God, they sprayed it all over. Oh. Well, it wasn't Agent Orange, buddy.
Right.
No. Well, anyway, that's I'm out of my soapbox. I didn't mean to get on that.
No, that's okay. I wanted to ask you about that anyway.
Yeah.
So go ahead about a typical mission. You would have the fighters shooting up in front of you.
And the only thing was it. We learned early in the game that they couldn't use 500-pound bombs because we were at 100 feet, and you know how high up a bomb throws stuff?
Mm-hmm.
We were flying through their debris, and we said, no. So we limited them to rockets, 20-millimeter, and CBU, which was the little round balls that came out of a tube, and they were about 3 inches across, circular.
Yes, sir.
And they were miserable little bastards. They were shrapnel.
Uh-huh.
We had a... we were on a mission one day when they had a brand new wing commander of an F-100 outfit. And so he gets in his airplane, he meets up with us, and we're flying along on our three-shipper, and he goes right across the top of us, and then he drops his CBU. I think he thought he was going to fire his 20 mic mic, but he fired off his CBU. And if you think Ballesti was something over in Europe, World War II, you should have seen those thousands of little things going off in the air and hitting our, then they hit our airplane and blow up. We took over 400 hits. So when we landed, I was going to say, oh shit, this is going to hit the fan, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Friendly fire and all that. All I know is that suddenly there appeared a whole bunch of these mechanics that are crew chiefs that could do fuselage repair.
Mm-hmm.
And they came from all over Southeast Asia. And the next morning we flew them same three airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So the old colonel, he figured out he blew it, so he gave us a hand.
Right.
And he fixed it right up. And so we claimed it was enemy fire.
No one reported what really happened.
Yeah. Of course. Why not? Who the hell cares, you know? Mm-hmm. 400 holes were fixed. Well, two windscreens knocked out, two engines knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
But that's normal. Normal flying.
Okay.
That's normal.
Okay, so approximately how long would your missions last? I guess it would depend on how far out you had to
go. Yeah, but normally, unless we went to Laos or someplace,
mm-hmm.
if we went out of country, that was way up in Laos around the Karsus up there. That was bad. That was we go up there to do crop. But if we did crop, that was a lot longer because you only pissed out about a little squirt
mm-hmm.
over each little plot of rice.
Mm-hmm.
And you spread out for that. You kind of went individual. It's kind of unseek, you know.
So you would go out and find rice paddies. And...
Yeah, we'd get in a valley, for example, and one guy would go up each side and one guy went up the middle, and we'd just weave along. We had a good spread between us, though, because we're afraid we're going to run into one another.
Mm-hmm.
And but those missions could take quite a while because you weren't putting out the full gamut of spray. You were just piddling out.
Now, this is, you said, in Laos a lot of times you would do this, or was this also in...
Well, it was primarily in a rice bowl up in northern South Vietnam.
Okay.
But we did in Laos. Yeah. We did it everywhere.
About how many missions do you think you flew in Laos?
Oh, I'd say less than... not very many, really.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. I flew 411 missions. I'd say probably 20 of them maybe were in Laos.
Was it any different flying in Laos than over South Vietnam?
No. Well, the country was totally different. The country was full of karst, little things that stuck in mountains, mm-hmm. mini mountains. And but the trail, we did the trail in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of that. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Maybe I did two more missions in Laos. I'd probably say 50 of them were out in Laos.
Okay. Did you take a lot of enemy fire in Laos?
No, not really. That was good. Although that's where Kubli got shot down. Boy, he got creamed by a 50, quad 50, they call it, 450 mm-hmm. cal sitting on the back of a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And he came around the corner and they just blew him out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in Laos. But that was unusual.
Now, you guys, were you aware that the United States had said that no foreign troops, including United States troops, would be in Laos?
Oh, hell, we had four... countries' insignias that were interchangeable on our airplanes.
Okay.
So I could go into Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, or Vietnam.
So you would put on the Royal Lao government's insignia
sure.
and fly?
Oh, well, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no question about that.
Okay, and same thing for Cambodia?
Yeah, but that was spookier. Now, when we first got there, we didn't exist. Mm-hmm. We worked for the ambassador, and we had no identification on us. We were, and if we went down, they would not admit us.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they decided to stick a Vietnamese num nose in the airplane, and that made it legal.
Mm-hmm.
So But the problem with that was that the Vietnamese that they picked to go with us on these flights, he would just go in one door and he'd jump right out the other side.
Oh, really?
They wouldn't go with us. Hell, they were scared of death. They knew what the mission was.
So they would, on paper, assign a Vietnamese to
him. Oh, yeah.
But he
was on the flight plan.
Yeah. He'd rarely go with you.
But he didn't go off. He didn't go in the air.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How many missions did you fly over Cambodia, do you think?
Not many. That was real touchy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we did just a little trail stuff going in there.
Mm-hmm.
I did one mission up north, and that didn't work too well either. So.
Tell me about that. What happened?
It was the, quote, secret mission,
mm-hmm.
and they had tried it way back in the beginning of the war. They tried to get to the Mekia Pass, and they never got there. They got shot at bad, so they stumped all their spray and hauled ass back to, where were they working out of? No, they were coming out of Da Nang, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this time out at Da Nang, they were going to try and, they're going to do the DMZ.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was kind of worthless, but now looking back on it, because the DMZ was just dead. There was nothing there. The B-52s had just obliterated everything up there.
Mm-hmm.
There was a tree stump. That was about all.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they wanted to do it. I think that was part of McNamara's wonderful dream,
mm-hmm.
which was stupid. He was, never mind.
Well, we'll get booked to that.
Yeah. Good, Tom, we've got to be careful. I get a little carried off on that one.
Okay.
But anyway, we did it. It was supposed to be secret. It was so secret. I almost had 10 news people hanging around us. We had to wait 10 days because the weather was so bad.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out later that we had 16 fighters,
mm-hmm.
Navy ships off the coast with 16-inch guns, 4 helicopters,
mm-hmm.
2 medevac helicopters. I can't tell you. Like we had, you never saw such a. It was an armada.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it.
Yeah. John Hart was on my airplane, so that's how secret it was. You know, they had a damn. He was a reporter for NBC, ABC, for Cronkite.
Uh-huh.
He was in the back of my airplane.
Uh-huh.
And we got 2 hits. That's all we took the whole time running through that DMZ.
Right.
And they were just above his head.
Okay.
And the poor bastard that shot off those 2 shots. He got, I think he had, I don't know. They would probably spend half the ammo that day fired in the enemy. It was dumped on them.
Oh, boy.
And another one like that.
Uh-huh.
When we were doing crop, we had B-57s
uh-huh.
on that run. And there were 3 of them.
Uh-huh.
Now, B-57, if you don't know what it is a twin-engine jet. Has bomb bay.
Mm-hmm.
And carries bombs on the outside, too.
Mm-hmm.
So they each carried 16 500-pounders. So... In the C-123, you could look up. It was glass top.
Mm-hmm.
You could look up through the roof, as well as look out the windows, of course. And we always blew the windows open because of ground fire. Anyway, we're doing crop, and Lee goes around the corner, and he says, hey, there was a... I was number 3 on that one.
Mm-hmm.
He said, there's a guy down there with a rifle. Didn't say anything about him shooting. Anyway, so then... Number 2 goes around the corner. He says, hey, man, he's working the bolt on that. He's going to shoot number 3.
Mm-hmm.
And about that time, I hear this voice say, number 3, get out of the way. I look up through the glass, and there are 3 B-57s, vertical, coming down.
Uh-huh.
Bomb bay's open. I couldn't move fast enough to get that bird out of the way.
Uh-huh.
They salvoed every one of their bombs on that poor old farmer.
Oh, God.
Never did get a shot off. My God, was that an expensive kill.
Yeah. So, this mission, you flew it, you dumped your stuff, and then you went back. With that, any major incidents?
You mean the one
of the DMZ?
Oh, no. We kind of thought it was a gravy run. That was minor, just 2 hits, and
okay.
Nobody hurt.
Okay.
And we got our spray out, you know, everything went fine. I don't remember any significance about it.
Okay. Was there any mission that you remember specifically, besides the one you just told me about and the others, that stand out in your mind? Any interesting things happen?
Hmm. I'm trying to think. Yeah, but it would be more humorous than anything else.
That's fine. Tell me.
Okay. We had an antenna that went from the tail of the aircraft to the top of the canopy in the front where the pilots sit.
Mm-hmm.
It's outside, way up high. And it's an HF antenna.
Mm-hmm.
high-frequency antenna. We very seldom used it. But anyway, we were going to go do what they call the chicken foot. It's a three valley affair that comes into the Ashaw Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like a chicken foot, three things. And so we had an intelligence briefing. They said, oh, quiet, nothing up there. Okay. So we go up, and I'm leading the airplane. So I led most of the time, but a lot of times I let the other guys lead just to keep them sharp.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we're going down this valley, and I couldn't believe the ground fire that opened up on us. I mean, it was fierce.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the shots that came through came right through my left engine. And that's next to where I'm sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And big holes blown out of the side. Crap flying inside the cockpit, inside the airplane. And so I figured we're dead. And Bob Eichelman's sitting there next to me. And I says, Bob, what do we got? He says, everything's fine. Nothing. It's running like a champ. And it did. The sound never changed with any engine.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, that's pretty damn good. We'll get out of this valley, though. So I pulled up and went in the next valley. They must have just, you know, goofed up a little bit down there. And they'd tell. Went to the next valley. And we got the daylight shot out of us again.
Mm.
This time, so going to the third valley. So I look back. Well, we're coming in. We're in trail, one behind the other.
Mm-hmm.
And here is number two. Has had his antenna shot off at the top of the cockpit,
mm-hmm.
and it's trailing behind him. And number three, feeling sporty that day, has got his cockpit stuck right up to it, to the trailing wire.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked just like number two was towing number three. And we always said about it when we came back. Well, I guess the VC will probably go back up north and say, man, you shoot up those ranch hands, and they're going to tow the airplanes over to target.
Yeah.
And there was one other funny incident along that line.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we were up at Da Nang. We lived in tents up there for a long time. And then finally we got into to sharing a cement building with the Jolly Greens, the guys that pick up pilots when they get shot down.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in there one night. Boy, the Jolly Greens came home, and they were yelling and screaming and laughing. They woke us all up, obviously. So we said, what are you guys laughing about? You never have anything at all to laugh about. And they said, yeah, we did. This time, you won't believe it. So at an F-4 go down, two pilots come out. Get over the first one, put the line down, and picked up the first guy, moved over to the second guy, and this guy in a black pajama jumps out, and we're in a hover. He says, we're dead. The guy points his AK-47 up. He looks, plays in front of the chopper, fires
mm-hmm.
off a whole banana clip.
Mm-hmm.
So the door gunner cuts this guy down.
Mm-hmm.
Wipes him out. They put down the PJ to get the last guy up, and he comes back up. He says, let's take a look at this, because he had the guy's AK-47 and anything else he had in his pockets.
Mm-hmm.
They said, hey, let's take a look at this. And they said, oh, I'll be damned, we got to get this faxed or copied and get 10,000 copies made. It showed an American chopper,
mm-hmm.
and it had three circles in front of it. And that's where you were taught to shoot if mm-hmm. you were a VC.
Mm-hmm.
So this one's sitting there in a hover. Where's this guy go? One, two, three, up front. Of course, they all didn't be a damn thing for the chopper guys. So they said, yeah, we'll get that copied and dropped all over the place.
Right.
Yeah.
How many people were on your crew?
On the lead airplane, there were four.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody else had three.
And what were their duties specifically?
Okay. A pilot and a co-pilot. And then they had a, we put a, flak vest over the radio
mm-hmm.
in the center, and the navigator sat there.
Okay.
There was no navigator position, mm-hmm. per se. And then in the back, there was a about a 3 foot high, it was made out of some kind of a composite, supposedly bullet resistant,
mm-hmm.
Square box, about 4x4x4. And the load mat, flight, we called him flight mat. Flight engineer, he could be anything you want to call him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a hell of a good guy, enlisted man. He was in there running the pump for the big tank.
Mm-hmm.
he also was the guy that he had the door open right from him. And when we called smoke out, if we were taking ground fire, he would put smoke out, which would be a red canister, mm-hmm. fire that out the door. And that would be where the fighters would know to go blow away some more.
Mm-hmm.
So there were four. Yeah, there were four of us on the lead airplane, three on all the others. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, if somebody was being, a new guy was being checked out, there'd be five.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, if you had an extra navigator on board.
Mm-hmm.
But and when you know the one airplane that got shot down over in Laos had five guys on board.
Did it really?
Yeah, what a shame. That was a heartbreaker.
Yeah. How much contact did you have with the other crew members? Pilot and co-pilot, could they talk to and see the navigator?
Oh, sure. We were all shoulder to shoulder.
Okay. Okay, yeah. It was that close.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Cramped quarters.
Okay.
And as far as living together, we all lived together. And we partied together. The enlisted guys would steal some beans and stuff from the mess hall. We had a contact with a Navy guy, with that Navy resupply ship that was up on the beach,
mm-hmm.
and we could get. But you had to take it in 50-pound boxes, you know, for about eight or nine of us. That's way too much. But we would get the stakes and take them down to mm-hmm. down in, behind the barracks, and we'd all sit around and do our thing together.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about base life. What was it like? Like where you lived and.
Well, at Da Nang, there wasn't any. It was an officer's club, and that was a lot of drinking and slot machines. And,
mm-hmm. Slot machines?
Yeah, we had slot machines all the time. We'd go to bed. Because we got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, 3
right.
o'clock in the morning.
Right. Where did you live, exactly? What was your hooch like?
Up north, you mean? At Da Nang?
At Saigon and then at Da Nang.
Oh, at Phnom Penh. We lived in town, downtown.
Okay.
But I didn't last long. Then... At Da Nang, we lived in tents almost all the time, and then finally got into a cement mm-hmm. building. It was reasonable. That was pretty good.
What was living in Saigon like?
Strange. I got a motorcycle as soon as I got in. I bought it from a guy leaving.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Harley Davidson. It was the only one in Vietnam, so nobody ever stole it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody couldn't get parts for it. Then it would stick out like a sore thumb. But anyway, one night my motorcycle stalled on me. I couldn't get it started. And I was hot bunking. That's called, you know, you do that when somebody else is up in Da Nang. I would take his bunk.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, anyway, I was coming back, pushed the motorcycle back, pushed it back in the yard, closed up the yard, put the anti-hand grenade stuff up, started back down the street, and here come about four guys on motorbikes,
mm-hmm.
and they started circling me. Uh-oh. So they were the cowboys. We called them cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
They were what they were. Their hair was greased back, and you had duck tails. You know, they were about 20 years behind the time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they were. So I got my back up against a street light post. And what they didn't know was that I had a .38 in my belt,
mm-hmm.
under my jacket.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't think I was armed. They kept circling me, and finally they got their knives out. They were trying to jump a curb and trying to slash at me at the same time. That gave me plenty of time to get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally figured out who the leader was. And when he jumped the curb, he had to get both hands on his handlebars to mm-hmm. keep the thing straight. I jumped on behind him.
Mm-hmm.
That just got his attention real quick.
Mm-hmm.
So the .38 I stuck in his ear. Well, he couldn't see that, so I put it around under him, stuck it up his nose.
Mm-hmm.
What he was yelling, but boy, they backed off pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "We're going to base now. We DD now to the base." And he knew what I meant, and so he started down the road. We got to the base, and I kicked him and his motorbike into the ditch at the entrance to the gate. And I told him to. By then I was a little hyper. I was telling the car to kill them all, kill them all. Well, I didn't shoot any, and he didn't shoot any, so that was the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it was like. You had to be careful in town.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What was your impression of the Vietnamese civilians?
Thieves.
Yeah?
Yeah. Of course, I only saw the bad ones. You know, I didn't see the good ones.
Mm-hmm. Did you have anyone working in your house, doing your laundry, doing your housework for you?
Yeah, but well, we had every pooch, wherever you were, even if you had a tent, you had somebody to do your uniforms and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they would take, you would buy the bush stuff, the suds, for them, and then they would just wear it out.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't get in. You couldn't. I got a hell of a rash one time because he used so much soap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Way too much. Double everything. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of quarters did you have in Saigon?
Well, I said we lived downtown.
Well, what was it? Was it a house?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, big house. Yeah.
Okay. And how many men were living in it?
Oh boy, 7, 8, 10 maybe.
Okay. And were
I never knew how many, to be honest with you.
Were they all ranch-in folks?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We were the same outfit.
Okay. How much free time did you have in the city itself?
None. Only nights.
Only sorry?
The night. Only the night. So I didn't have any free time. I was flying every day.
What would you do during the night?
Drink.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of drinking over there.
Did you have a particular club that you went to? Or?
Oh, hell no. I wasn't down there that long. Okay. I was on Tudo Street. I just tried every one of the bars probably along the way. That was that. No, I wasn't a Saigoner, see. I was there such a short time.
Right.
And by the time I was out, getting ready to come out of Da Nang, we were now living down in, we were in Benoit. You didn't even go down there.
Mm-hmm.
And in Benoit, they had a, we were put up in an old French cavalry, what do you keep horses in? What do they keep horses in?
Stable?
Yeah, stable. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it was a big one. It would house about 12 guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down and I flew down to look it over. Looked down all over. Heck, I kicked down. Everybody's bunked down about a half a foot. That made quite a few, but picked me up pretty well. So I had a nice area there, and I went and got some lumber. Closed it in. I had a box that had been sitting there for about 6 months, and it was an air conditioner, which was illegal over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down to supply, and I got 100 feet of cable, and I hooked up the air conditioner. I cut a hole in the back of the damn staple wall and shoved the thing in there. Ran the cable, buried it in the sand, ran it over to the club, went in, threw it in a hole behind the jukebox and plugged in behind the jukebox, and nobody knew what the hell it was connected to. I had air, and then we had some other deal going where we picked up strange things. One of them was we picked up all the acoustical tile type stuff. It's not tile; it's like beaver board that was meant for some colonel's trailer somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my place in that, so now I had a closed-in, almost soundproof.
Mm-hmm.
Thing. It was only about 6 feet by 9 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a chair that I bought up in Taipei, and a lamp I bought up in Taipei, stand-up lamp. And I got a colonel's bed from Sarge for a bottle of booze.
Mm-hmm.
And I got sheets from home.
Mm-hmm.
And I got myself a wall locker and a big lock on it. And my folks, or my mother and my wife, were sending me all kinds of wonderful canned salamis and cheeses. And
mm-hmm.
So that looked pretty good. That was pretty good. It's called Taj Mahal East.
And your stable or your quarters itself?
This is in the stable.
Right.
But I was the only one that had it closed in and had an air conditioner.
Okay. So you called your quarters the Taj Mahal East.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and it was just driving the other guys nuts.
Yeah.
Remember now, these are all officers.
Right.
And they were living in the stable, but I was living in Taj Mahal.
Now, why was the air conditioner illegal?
Power.
Okay.
They couldn't afford the power to run one.
Okay.
So, anyway, they got back at me. They every once in a while, one of them would go by and just drop a smoke bomb right in my air conditioner. And I'm telling you, whatever color it was, everything in there turned.
Mm.
Me and stuff in it, everything. Mm. It was a green one. It was all green. It was funny. I never got mad about it because I was living pretty good anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I gave that and my motorcycle and everything else away to the next guy behind me. $250
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How much contact did you have with home while you were there?
With
home, with your wife and your parents?
No, just mail.
Uh-huh.
I made one phone call home.
Yeah?
But I got cut off. They shut me off as soon as I said hello to my mother. Uh-huh. Everything's all right. Click, they shut me right off.
Okay.
So I didn't even try anymore.
How often would you write letters?
Oh, I wrote a lot of letters. Mm-hmm. I tried them every 3 or 4 days. And my wife the same.
Okay.
Yeah. Very little. I never took an R&R with my wife.
But you did take an R&R to Taipei?
I took it to Hong Kong.
To Hong Kong. Okay.
I got food poisoning the day I got there.
Okay.
I crawled back on the airplane 5 days later. I'd never been out of the hotel.
Really?
Oh, was I a sick dog. Uh-huh. So I wrote back to them later, though. I asked them to send me some brochures so I could see what the hell the town was like. I'd never seen. I took my wife back there many years later and did enjoy Hong Kong.
How much? How often were you able to keep up with the news back in the United States?
Well, we got the Stars and Stripes,
mm-hmm.
the paper.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember anything else.
Did you have access to a television?
Hmm. That's an interesting thought. I don't remember it. If we did, I don't remember it now. No, I don't think so. I'm sure there may have been one someplace, but I didn't see it.
And you said that
we weren't hurting too bad over there. Don't get me wrong, we were living pretty good.
Right, right.
We had a club. We had plenty of booze. We had a lot of lousy food. But
what would you do for entertainment, for example?
Play slot machines.
Now, would you actually win money on them?
Sure.
Yeah. Were these U.S. government slot machines?
Oh, of course. I had to be there in the officers' club.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of my pilots was absolute genius at throwing the dice.
Really?
And I stood behind him one night and just bet around him.
Mm-hmm.
Small stuff. Mm-hmm. And I made $2,000.
In that one night?
Yeah. God, I couldn't believe it. I don't know how much he made. But he played. He was gambling every night. I wasn't. I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't that good at it, but I played slot machines, though. Yeah. I lived on slot machines. That and cheap VO, 25 cents a shot.
Uh-huh. Was there any tension at all or between you, someone who was an officer, and then those who were being drafted?
No, my guys were all double volunteers.
Really?
Yeah, in order to get in the outfit that I was in, uh-huh. you had to volunteer to go to Vietnam,
uh-huh.
and then you had to volunteer to go to this outfit. So I had some pretty motivated people. I mean, you
sounds
talk
like
about,
it.
Yeah, well, the Esprit de Corps was over head and shoulders above anything else. Maybe there's a Marine outfit that might be as good.
Mm-hmm.
But like I say, it's 30-some years later, we still meet.
Right. So good morale amongst your men?
Oh, yeah, higher than a kite. What the hell's the general, shoot, forgot his name. He's right here in the States now,
mm-hmm.
head of their Air Force. I can't remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
But we were stationed right next to him, our airplanes were.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his crew group there, about 6-8 A-1s, and people on standby all the time around his hooch.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked our esprit de corps and our morale. He gave us all purple scarves.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, boy, was that a big deal.
Did he hold a ceremony for you, or?
No. Well, yeah, but it wasn't no big thing out in the field.
Uh-huh.
Right there, we're all right there with him, you know.
Right.
Key, General Key. Yeah, I got it. Anyway, he gave us these purple scarves,
mm-hmm.
and we were pretty damn proud of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we were wearing sidearms and carrying M16s, and whatever Thompsons, whatever we wanted to carry around with us,
mm-hmm.
and. We had baseball hats, and we had some wild insignias, patches.
Mm-hmm.
We had some lusty ones about what Jink Fonda could do, you know,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, Momeyer, came in, this general.
Mm-hmm.
He said, everything goes. The baseball caps go. The scarves go. The sidearms go. Blah, 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 blah. We're going to beautify the area. Everybody's going to clean up the area. We're going to paint up everything. So anyway, I'm up in Da Nang, and I've got my purple scarf on. And the wing commander up there, his bird colonel, says, "You got to take that scarf off." I said, "I don't take the scarf off for anybody." He says, "Well, we'll see about that." So he calls down to Saigon. And I don't know who he talked to. I have no idea. But he said, pretty soon he hangs up the phone and slams. He says, "Get out of here. I don't want you in this briefing anymore." I said, "What happened?" "Oh, I don't want to hear it." So I called my boss down in Saigon. I said, "What the hell happened down there?" He said, "This colonel up there called down to Saigon and told him he was going to take our scarves off." The guy down in Saigon says, "I checked with General Key. He said if you take the scarves off them," he says, "I'll close the gates." That's the biggest air base in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That was the end of that. I had no trouble with that. Mm-hmm. We never did get our cowboy hats back or anything, but we did get our scarves.
Did you take that home with you?
The scarf?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you betcha. Every one of us still have them.
Still have it.
We go to a reunion, you'll see them. They're all wearing them.
Uh-huh. What kind of contact did you have with other allied forces, like the South Koreans or the Australians or New Zealanders?
Nothing to do with the South Koreans.
Why not?
There was nothing to do with them. They weren't doing anything for us.
Okay.
Their Air Force had given up on giving us top cover. So they wouldn't go down through the clouds.
They wouldn't go down through the clouds?
No. They were worthless to us.
Uh-huh.
So we gave up on them. We got regular air cover from other U.S. things. We've had Navy and all that. We never saw these people. We talked to them over the air.
Mm-hmm. Never saw them at base camp or anything?
No.
Okay.
They all had their own little enclaves in different places.
Right.
Yeah.
How about the South Vietnamese military forces? What kind of contact did you have with them?
Zero. They were worthless, too.
Why do you say that?
Well, we were Air Force, and they were ground. We'd never dealt with them.
How about the South Vietnamese Air Force?
No, I say, they wouldn't come down through the clouds, so we wrote them off as a total loss.
So the Koreans and the South Vietnamese Air Force were both, they would not help you out in the air? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there was no Korean there.
Okay, I had asked you about the South Koreans.
I'm sorry, that went right over my head.
Okay.
No, I'll tell you what, they were a ground force, and they were sort of a formidable group.
Right.
They were the nastiest bunch of people. They would skin the people they caught.
Yeah?
Yeah. Ooh.
Did you ever meet any of them?
No.
You just heard stories?
I saw one in the middle of the street one day. He got hit by a car. He got knocked about 10 feet down the road. He rolled and rolled and rolled. He got right up, brushed himself off. He looked like he was one of the toughest brothers in the valley. And he took a heck of a lick from a car.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So tell me about the South Vietnamese. In the air, they would not provide you cover that you wanted.
No. Uh-huh. Oh, no, if it was cloudy, they wouldn't go through the clouds.
Why not?
I guess they don't know how to fly any instruments, so I don't know.
Okay. And how about on the ground? Did you ever have any contact?
No. In fact, I didn't want any contact with them on the ground.
Why not?
I figured half of them were defectors, or what do you call them? Infiltrators.
Uh-huh.
They were the ones who were giving away all of our targeting.
The South Vietnamese forces who were working for both sides.
Sure.
Yeah. Do you think that was common, that they were giving away information, or that information was readily available to the enemy?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. The thing is, maybe it wasn't just them alone. I think that they had the North Vietnamese had a tremendous take on our communications
mm-hmm.
Facilities. In other words, they could tap in everywhere along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And after we opened up some of those the tunnels, they were massive.
Mm-hmm.
They had hospitals down there, chow halls, and I don't know what all.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to believe that they could do all that.
How would you describe the enemy?
I'm sorry?
How would you describe the enemy, the VC and then...
Well, that sucker was something else. He was a real enemy. He was a formidable enemy. He could... He was using bulldozers and road graders and I don't know what all, way down in South Vietnam. He was building roads at a rate like, God, if they could build roads like that in the United States, we'd be pretty clean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was very, very versatile. Very versatile. And he had thousands of people involved.
Mm-hmm.
We saw where they, We'd open up a road, they'd bomb it, and before we ever got back there again, it was just like we nobody'd ever been there with a bomb.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Did your impression of them change once you got in country, or did it evolve? Or
no, of course, I never talked to any of them. I don't know. They were just somebody on the ground that I had to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew they were shooting at me,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't shoot back. See, that was really the big gripe I had with going over there. I wanted to go over to the fire pile. I could blow them away.
Right.
And I couldn't do it.
Right.
But we did have free fire zones, so I could call in airstrikes.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a CBU, a particular CBU. It was called CBU-24.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like a football. When it exploded in the air,
mm-hmm.
it made a pattern that would look just like a football, pointed at both ends.
Mm-hmm.
And it was devastating. It was the most devastating armament that we could call for.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down across a river one time, and they blew the daylights out of us. So when I got on the ground, I said, "Yeah, I need some CBU-24 for the next time we go there." And they said, "Well, you know, you can only have that with troops in contact." I said, "What the hell do you think we are? We're in contact all the time."
Mm-hmm.
So somebody up there finally realized that, yeah, these guys probably could use this thing. So I set it up so that we'd start out, get way up the one end of the river coming down, and this one F-100 with four CBUs on it would start ahead of us, and he'd pull up, drop one, go down, drop the next one, next town. He took out four towns, leveled them knee-high.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people he killed, but it didn't bother me that they were shooting at us.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a massive wreck. Ooh, that was great.
Did you call in ordnance a lot?
Oh, yeah. Did I ever? Yeah. I didn't have to. All we had to do was get a shot fired at us.
Mm-hmm.
And we would yell, you know, ground fire, right, left, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys would really take care of it.
Did you try to discriminate between shots being fired and then civilian population that was in the area as well?
Or? Hell no. Why? They were all VC anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would just take out the whole area if you could?
I hope so. I had a mission down in the flatlands one of the times I was down south.
Mm-hmm.
And the south country was just flat. You could see for miles and miles and miles. There were no hills there. There was nothing to stop you. We always came in from the water there. I mean, low on the water, pop up on a beach and start spraying. Well, we came up on this line of hooches one time, and there's a lady in the door with a baby in her arms, and there's a guy behind her with his M6, AK-47 on her shoulder, and he's blazing away at us. And about that time, I guess we had F-100s then. I don't know what we had. A-1? Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, wherever our top cover was, just flashed underneath my wing and blew this guy and the gal and the baby and everything all to hell. I was fine.
How did he drop a bomb or was it?
No, a 20-mic mic.
20-mic mic,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, machine guns, nose guns. So we went right over the place and kept right on going. So about, I guess it was, how long did they normally wait? Well, it wasn't that long. We came this way again. And I'd be darned if not the same guy, obviously not. Same situation. As if it was a deja vu. Guy hanging his AK-47 over his gal's shoulder and blazing away at us. And this one got chopped down just as quick as the other one did. I don't know what the hell that was all about. But that's what it was like, you know. You just didn't know who the hell you... There weren't any good guys over there.
Was there any discussion about trying to distinguish between the civilian population and the enemy?
No. We never talked about collateral damage.
Really?
Never gave it a thought.
Okay. Was that true for all the ranch hand missions, do you think, or the ones in sea flight? Or?
I would assume it was everybody else, because we all had the same marching orders.
Uh-huh. In your briefings in the morning, did they talk about kind of, you know, this? There are a couple towns here in this area, so...
They either said this is a hot area where there's no intelligence or no, they were right about 10% of the time.
Oh, really?
Oh, terrible. Intel was terrible.
Bad intelligence.
Oh, it was really bad. Well, it was like that Three Valley thing.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
On the Third Valley, I'd shot up so bad, I said, I can't believe this. had one, we had a mission over a pineapple forest, and I was going to lead it. And John Beakley said, "No, I want that mission. I want that mission. I haven't got enough. You're getting more missions than anybody else." Blah blah blah. So he got me drunk, and he says, "I'm going to take that mission tomorrow." I said, "Okay, John, you take that mission tomorrow." Sure enough, he went over the Pineapple Valley, and they shot him. Shot one through the canopy, shot him in the head. Now it didn't kill him. It went into his helmet, around his helmet, and stuck in the skin of his head to the left side of his forehead. And he says, I left out the part that Intel said this was a quiet run.
Okay.
Yeah. And then so John gets the daylight shot at him. So they put the thing on the runway. Chopper waiting for him. Take him over to the Marine. Fix you up quick. They wrap a bandage around his head. You know, back to duty. So, anyway, make a long story short. John gets to the club, and we're all partying because John got shot up, which was about John's third time. And he breaks the. He says, "I want to dance with the intelligence officer." I couldn't believe what the hell he saw. He did. He danced with me. He threw him right up against the wall and broke his arm. Which was a good idea. We all agreed on that.
Mm-hmm.
It was good, yeah.
Did you complain about the lack of good intelligence?
No, we didn't talk to him. There was nobody to talk to. No.
Well, I would think the intelligence officer and then on up the chain, but apparently that was not possible.
Oh, hell no. Nobody ever asked us either, so. It was the way the war went, you know. You just went on what you had.
Mm-hmm.
But you finally became, like I said, we went to tertiary targets.
Mm-hmm.
When we did that, we cut our hits in half.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that should tell people down in Saigon something.
Did you tell them that you were doing this?
Sure.
And they approved?
No. So you got to stick to what we tell you to do. Sure, sure, Colonel. We'll do that. I kill.
Okay.
We had a winner, and we were going to leave it a go.
Uh-huh. Your tour was for 1 year, is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. And you went in 1965, and you left in 66.
No, I didn't get there in 66.
66, 67, okay. Did your impression of the war change from when you first arrived until when you left? And if it
No, I was there right at the peak of what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
We sprayed more in that 1 year period than they did in any other, probably a combined two or three others.
Mm-hmm.
And we took more hits, and we took more. Everything. But everything stayed the same for us. It was a continued operation. Nothing changed. And we didn't seem like we were winning the war or losing the war.
Hmm.
You know, it was static.
So you couldn't really gauge the progress of the war?
Not a bit. Never had a clue. The only impression I got was my father died while I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought me home on emergency leave, which was fantastic how they did it. But anyway, they had me home like something 18 hours from the time they told me in Vietnam to get out of the cockpit. And the time I drove a rental car up to my house.
Did they tell you?
He was critical, that was all.
Okay.
He hadn't died yet. He didn't die until I got into the States, but I never got home in time.
Uh-huh.
But that's okay. But while I was home, now I had a reprieve, you know. And it was pretty good because I was getting pretty flaky. And I'm looking at the newspapers. Remember, I'm at Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the body places where they pile them up, send them home.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Tonsonute, of course, another one. And the other was Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw at least 125 a week going out of Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
I get home, and they're showing less than 125 out of all of Vietnam each week. That was a bunch of crap.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what the media was doing with that info, but it was feeding it to them, but it was all wet.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all young kids. That was a bad part.
Mm-hmm. You said you were getting flaky. What do you mean by that?
Oh, geez, you get combat squirrely.
Uh-huh.
Well, you get to where you're right, wrong, left, right. Everything is screwed up. You're just running on adrenaline. You don't even know what you're doing.
Was that true for the other members in your crew?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Now, two of them had a gimmick they were working on me. They'd get themselves shot in the face. Because that was a big problem with the flying of their birds. We had armor plate around us, you know, on a shoulder high and seat. But the windscreen and the windows were all trouble. And if you got hit in the windscreen, you got all this glass in your face, and your face blew up like a balloon. Mm-hmm. And you looked like hell. And your arms, whatever part of you was exposed. Mm-hmm. So two guys, John and Clyde, got shot together. It seemed like every other day for a while. Mm-hmm. And the first time they got shot, I said, take off 3 days, get yourself healed up, go on up to Tetchikow and drink booze at the bar, act like a human being. So off they went. Well, they came back, happened again. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, going Tetchy? No, hell no. Not going up looking like this. Why don't we heal up and then we'll take our 3 days up there? They were funny. They were something else. And it was a fun stop, though, in Florida when Clyde took a 50 through the bottom of the airplane, up through his, hit it just above his heel, and went all the way up to his knee. And that's as far as it went. But that wasn't funny. That was not funny at all.
What happened to him?
We sent him home. Mm-hmm. That was his third or fourth Purple Heart. Mm-hmm. That's enough. He had enough.
Was there a number where you would get to where you know, three Purple Hearts, four Purple Hearts, and then you would go?
No. There was nothing like that.
Okay. But, just the seriousness of the wound, I guess, would dictate.
No, it's just that, well, in our case, we had the option to send them home. Mm-hmm. And nobody argued with us. But that was enough of him. Mm-hmm. He ultimately recovered fine. You know, he's a city commissioner in Fort Worth right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nice guy.
How much direct exposure did you have to Agent Orange?
Oh, well, now, I'm glad you asked that. Mm-hmm. Okay, right now I'm considered the most highly exposed person in the world to Agent Orange.
Okay?
Okay. I have served on the White House Committee. I've served on the VA Committee. I've been to Australia and testified before to their parliament. And on and on. But anyway. When you're flying the airplane, you fly with a pressurized tank, 80 PSI. A bullet hits that, and it's coming out in a cloud. Now, if you've ever driven in a station wagon and had the back open, you know the fumes come in. And, you know, it's a physical thing. So when this tank got hit, which gets hit frequently, you know, it sprays out, and it comes right up in the cockpit, and it just envelops us. Mm-hmm. Now, we got soaked in it regularly. So next GI tells me I'm soaking him. He's got another thought coming. But anyway, we really took a licking on that. And our crew chiefs even took it worse because they were further back and right by the tank. Mm-hmm. One of them one day, for example, they were flying. They lost an engine. And they were so heavy, they'd never get out of the valley. He stepped off to the side with his M16s and shot holes all through the tank. Mm-hmm. That's one way to drain it. Because he pulled the dump valve and nothing happened. And he said, okay, bang, bang, bang. So he blew it away.
So you had a lot of exposure to the
Orange. Oh, sure.
Every day.
And it showed. You know, I mean, everybody knew it. And the medical world has acknowledged it, so.
And so what kind of side effects have you experienced from that exposure?
Zero.
Okay. Except having your boots eaten away after 3 months.
Yeah, you had to get new boots. So. Now, at this point in time in my life, I've lost a lung.
Mm-hmm.
I have diabetes, secondary diabetes number 2, whatever the hell it is. I was 72 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? Glaucoma. But none of them are directly related to Agent Orange that I know of. Mm-hmm. Although I have got 100% disability. I don't know if that turned that down.
Mm-hmm.
But I smoked for 47 years, you know, so blame that on a chest or the lung problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about your diabetes? Is there any linkage that you're
aware? Yeah, they say there is. And it's amazing. So many of us do have some form of it.
Mm-hmm.
Usually the older guys, we have the number 2, stage 2.
So there is some side effect then?
Possibly. Very possible. I don't know. I'm not going to deny it, but I'm certainly not going to endorse it either.
Okay. Why?
Remember, we're tested by the Air Force.
Right.
And the Air Force. Are you part of the Air Force study?
Am I part of it?
Yeah.
No, not personally.
Oh, I didn't. No, Foundation part of it?
Yes. Oh, yeah. We've interviewed veterans who've been part of that, and we're aware of it.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I'm sure you knew about it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's plenty of information there. My goodness gracious.
Now, let me. So, do you personally think that there's no side effect at all? Just from your own experience, you're saying there's no side effect.
I'm here talking to you.
Okay. What about those who do claim there's a side effect?
I don't know. I don't want to badmouth them and say that they're crying. They probably have a real problem. I don't know what it is, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Orange even did it. But once they're on the ground, now if they're Army, there's a very good possibility that they were spraying it themselves all over the place.
Right.
And there's about, I think they said there's 2% of the spray that we sprayed in the Air Force sprayed, that was passed off to the Army, and it was pushed out in huge quantities by trucks with sprays in the back, mm-hmm. all around the camp.
Right.
Jesus, of course you're going to get it. You're going to get a problem there, I'll tell you that. Ooh. Now, malathion, you know, has probably got some problems, too. And they were using that under their cots. They'd spray the inside the tents underneath the cots.
Mm-hmm. So. How do you think the government has treated its Vietnam veterans over the years?
Well, I guess I could say I got treated all right. Everything I asked for, I got.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I'd love to see that double, whatever the hell it's called, double dip thing go through so I could get both my... my disability pay and my retired pay.
Mm-hmm.
It's double my income right
mm-hmm.
there.
Now, why do you have 100% disability? What is it for?
Because I've got a lung out and because I've got stage 2 diabetes.
Okay.
They're both compensable.
Okay.
Yeah. I remember now, I smoked for 47 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, what today, looking back, when you left Vietnam, how did you feel about your service there?
I was proud of it.
Yeah.
I saved all my medals and had one great big ceremony when I got back.
Mm-hmm.
I had my wife there, had two generals there, and I was the hero of the day.
And
it was funny because the general came up with the first medal was a DFC,
uh-huh.
Distinguished Flying Cross. And there was a big board in an easel. All these medals were on it. So then he went and they got another one. The guy read off all the citations. What a wonderful guy I was and all that. Hero of the year. And he pins that one. As I whispered to him, General, all of them are mine. Why don't we just say thanks and goodbye? He looked over at the other guy and said, is he right? The guy said, yeah. He says, and so, Colonel Hubs. Blah, blah, blah. I saluted him. He saluted me. And we called it off.
Mm-hmm.
23 medals.
23 medals.
That's it. It's absurd.
How much did people ask you about the war when you arrived home?
Nobody asked me anything. Oh, yeah, wait a minute. They did. I'm sorry. The Navy had a program. McNamara was still playing around with this stupid goddamn wall.
Mm-hmm.
They had me go over to the vice president's quarters over in Diggs over in the Naval Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was in Washington at that time. So I said, okay. Went over and they said, okay, now here's what we're going to do. We're going to take Navy P-2V airplanes, which dispense buoys in the water,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to seed the whole trail, and then anytime we hear footsteps, we'll bomb it.
Okay.
I said, gee, that's great. They said, now the only reason we asked you over here is because you know the terrain, and we want to know, you know, we're going to bring these airplanes in up the hill. I said, whoa, right off the bat. They said, you know, do nothing up the hill. They shoot an engine out, you won't be able to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, yeah. I said, how much G-forces are these planes listed at? They're P-2Vs. They said, 1.6, 1.8 G's. I said, good Christ, man, if you had 6 G's in the goddamn gusts up there,
mm-hmm.
you'll pull the wings off. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous, and I guess I don't know if they ever went through with it or not. I'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
But they were honestly going to go uphill, getting ground fire.
Mm-hmm.
It's stupid. And then they were going to use an airplane that couldn't take the gusts in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Nobody knows. Only the Buddha knows about that one.
Was that a one-time consultation you gave him?
Yeah. Okay. Although I did a lot of talking at the various committees I was on, the VA committee, the White House committee, all those.
When were you put on those committees?
67.
Right after you came back?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
I was a hot item.
The Agent Orange.
Yeah. Okay. They brought me back. They saw the film clip of, it was a 6 minute, I had 6 minutes on Cronkite.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw this clip, and the flying, and the guns going off, and bullet holes in the airplanes, and the sound of the bullets in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And some general said, "My God, that guy has..." Oh, and in the meantime, John Hart, wonderful, says, "This is the most shot at and hit commander in Vietnam." Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Oh boy. So it wasn't true, because there's dust off and chopper guys that took a hell of a lot more than I did. But anyway, I get these orders back to the States, straight directly to the systems command to take care of shot down pilots. I said, "What do you mean? I never got shot down. If I got shot up, I never got shot down. I don't know squat about this. I know anything about it." "Well, you're it." Well, anyway, that put me in the Washington area, and that was when everybody could get their hands on me. So they put me on all these committees. Blah, 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 blah. Anyway, end of story for that, anyway.
Right. How much difficulty did you have, or any at all, transitioning back into life in the United States?
Only one, two incidents. One, when I hit the States, I landed in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I got spit on.
Okay, was this at the airport?
Yep.
Were you in uniform? You're in uniform.
Yep.
Okay.
And it was amazing, because there was a policeman that saw it happen. And he went over, and he got the guy, and he's up on his arm up behind him, and he's into the men's room. And he beats the crap out of the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "I appreciate that." He said, Third Marine Air Wing. He was a returnee, too.
Okay.
So that was pretty nice. But then the other time was where my wife, we were over in Scranton, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
At her mother's house. And I was driving, and we were going down a small alley in Scranton.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there was a guy with a jackhammer, fired it off. And I dove under the thing. I was driving, and I went underneath the dashboard.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. And it just really got me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and one other thing. In our car, we had the back seat. We had ashtrays with lids on them.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids seemed to just enjoy snapping those lids,
mm-hmm.
and it sounded just exactly like a 30 cal going through the skin of aluminum skin of an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to stop that right away.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I still jump a lot at loud noises.
Do you?
But that's about all I can think of. I don't have any other. No other noticeable things anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Wife still lives with me. So I guess we're all right.
How many civilians asked you about your Vietnam experience when you returned?
I didn't have that many friends that were civilians.
Okay.
I was a regular military, a regular officer,
mm-hmm.
and I hung around with officers
mm-hmm.
and military.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think there was any civilians at all involved with anything. None of them ever asked me anything anyway.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you think they didn't ask? Was it such an unpopular war?
Well, I don't know. I have no way of telling. There was so little contact. I don't think that it would ever come up. You know, if I had any contact with it, it was probably to do something, to get something done, and that was it. There was very little sitting around philosophizing.
Right. When you came back, did you keep up with what was happening in Vietnam, U.S. policy,
oh, yeah.
The war?
Oh, yeah. I read the hit who got shot down
uh-huh.
thing regularly. And then my best buddy went down, I knew we were in trouble.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What did you think of the rest of the progress of the war the United States was prosecuting there?
It was deteriorating at a rapid rate.
So.
Not immediately, but then it got really bad. We should have been out of there a couple of years earlier than we were.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't going to win it. Not with the mindset that they had in Washington.
Mm-hmm. What was that mindset?
It was never bomb the dikes, which would have ended the war immediately. The dikes were the most important target in all of North Vietnam. And the other was to bomb the rail line right up to the Chinese border.
Mm-hmm. So bombing the dikes, meaning flooding out Hanoi.
You betcha. Would have wiped out their food supply for years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Why do you think the United States did not do that?
Oh, because we're such a loving, gentle group of people.
Okay. And what about not bombing the railroads?
Again, it was too close to China.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think the United States was prosecuting the war in that fashion?
I'll never know, but it was stupid. It's probably one of the worst scenarios I've ever seen in my life as a military person. They had so many restrictions on those poor guys up there flying fighters and bombers.
Mm-hmm.
You can't believe it. I mean, it was unreal. I didn't have that problem. I had the problem initially when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
We solved it by tertiary targeting.
Right.
Yeah. But we were able to get around it. But remember, we're a little bitty outfit. Nobody would get wise to us.
Mm-hmm.
Goofing off.
What did you think of the United States' Vietnamization policy of turning the war back to the Vietnamese to let them fight their own war?
No, I think we should have done that about 1966.
Really?
Yeah. Well, in hindsight, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Probably a good idea. No sense in killing any more Americans. We were wasting lives over there. We were all kids. Everybody got killed over there when they were a kid.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the Vietnamese were capable of fighting their own war against
no,
the war?
No, hell no. They couldn't fight their own war. No.
Why not?
They're just not. They don't. The ones up north are militarized and they're regimented and that's the way they live.
Mm-hmm.
The ones down south are sloth. Stumble along in their own way.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about going back to Vietnam?
I wouldn't go back on a bet. I never left anything there. I don't want to go back.
Yeah.
You mean to visit, like John McCain?
Sure.
You know, I know John. John's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
John and I were at Bud Day's Medal of Honor ceremony, and John, of course, was his cellmate, Bud's cellmate.
Mm-hmm.
And Bud and I have been together for 40-some years. And I couldn't believe John went back. And he's pacifying those bastards. I don't know. I can't believe that. Boy, Bud's not very happy about that.
Really?
And they were cellmates for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Vietnam today?
Today?
Yes. And about American policy toward Vietnam today?
Well, Christ, we're giving them the goddamn keys to the kingdom. I think. If I read it right in the papers, we're doing all kinds of things to help them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we get their oil, maybe that'd be worth it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to see. It's a little bit out of my... It's above my pay grade. How's that?
Have you talked to Senator McCain about it?
No, not about his trips. I don't know.
Oh, no, just about American policy.
No, I don't. My bud does all the time, but I don't.
What do you think of the media coverage of the war?
Terrible. Those lying bastards. Boy, they were terrible. Goddamn left-wing sorry bastards.
Can you?
I hope you're not. If you are, I don't care. I mean that.
Well, I know that. Tell me, explain what you mean by that.
Well, they're still left-wing bunch of bastards. they are so bad, and it's so obvious. Yet nobody gets on. I don't know why nobody can figure them out.
What was done inaccurately about the Vietnam War?
Body count for openers.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I know they had access to better than that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were anti-war to begin with, and they stayed anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't anything. You could buy a newspaper during the Vietnam War. They should have outlined it in black.
I'm sorry. You should have what?
Outlined the paper in black, the front page.
Uh huh.
Like an obituary, you know.
Okay.
Oh, well, never mind. I'm on my bed.
That's I want to know what you think. Tell me about today's media coverage of looking, you know, at American military policy and, for example, the media coverage of the Persian Gulf War and then the
Well, the fact that they're prosecuting two pilots for dropping a bomb. If there was so much friendly fire deaths in the last bunch of years.
Mm-hmm.
You can't believe it. Why are you prosecuting these two guys?
Mm-hmm.
Christ.
The press is getting these two guys, you think?
Nah, but they're following it like it was a done deal, you know. I don't know. I'm saying even the, well, yeah, that's right. It is the government that's doing that. But that bugs me, too, because I know what friendly fire is. I probably killed a zillion civilians over there. Mm-hmm. And I sleep well at night. I don't have any problem with it. But they shouldn't be after those two pilots. They aren't the government. Now, that's my grip on that.
What do you think about the United States government prosecution of the war, just looking back at it?
Which one? The one we're coming up?
The Vietnam War. I'm sorry.
Oh, Vietnam War.
Yes, sir.
Well, I think they started out with good intentions. Mm-hmm. But we let the thing get away from us, and we let the White House start dictating how to fly, fight a war.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why we got generals. Mm-hmm. And so and it just got kind of messed up. No, I didn't think it was very good. They had. I think they started out right. I was all for it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't wait to get there.
Right.
But in hindsight, terrible. Terrible.
Have you read books about the Vietnam War?
Oh, yeah. I read all about World 105 guy that got court-martialed for blowing up a freighter that was shooting at him in the harbor. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe that. Oh, well. But, yeah, I've read just about every book I can find on it.
What do you think about them?
Well, the book writers are pretty honest. Mm-hmm. I haven't read any left-wing book writers, but I've read guys, most guys are just like me, that telling it like it was.
Okay. Okay, sir.
He got a quick line of calling me, sir. Now, you see, in 1976, I quit being sir or colonel.
Uh-huh.
I became, or mister even, I became Charlie.
You became Charlie.
I became Charlie. It's real easy. And I answer to it a lot better.
Uh-huh. Okay, Charlie.
That's it.
Okay. Looking back at your service, is there anything that you would change about your experience there in Vietnam?
Yeah, I'd like to have been a Thud pilot. I'd probably been shot down on my first mission too.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to shoot at him.
Right.
You know, Richard, it's really funny. Fighter pilots are strange people.
How's that?
Well, they're macho, and if there's a job to be done, to go out and do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And shooting guns at bad guys is the answer in war.
Mm-hmm.
And to go out there and let them shoot at you and not shoot back, frustrating.
Well, it sounds like you fit the criteria. You're being macho and confident, and you wanted to get in the fight, and you were in the fight. You just simply
wasn't in the piece of machinery I wanted to be in.
Right. Is that so? That's something that you would want to redo if you could.
Oh yeah, I'd like to. I would go back in a blink of an eye as a Thud pilot,
mm-hmm.
which is a 105.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using jargon here that I should clarify. If you ever use a word that you don't understand, just ask me. I'm sorry.
I've heard most of them, and I think it's good for you to use that jargon because that's your recollection. That's how you talk. That's your experience.
Oh yeah,
and that's fine. And for folks who listen to this interview in the future. They'll be able to look that stuff up.
Yeah. Well, do a little editing, though.
Exactly.
Cut out some of my cussing there.
No. That's not necessary, sir. This is who you are. Excuse me, Charlie. That's right. This is your experience, and so that's what's important here.
Okay.
Do you think the United States learned any lessons from the Vietnam War?
Yeah, they learned that the next time they go to war, like the Desert Storm,
mm-hmm.
be ready, have everything ready in place, and go.
Mm-hmm.
And then they quit before they won the war. Now, they didn't learn anything, did they? But they learned it. They learned how to prepare for a war.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't learn how to win the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that makes me unhappy.
Mm-hmm. What did you learn in Vietnam yourself that one year?
Oh, I learned a lot about myself.
Such as?
Oh, man, I know. I found out that I could drink an awful lot. And I'm serious. I could drink an awful lot and get up and fly
uh-huh.
without any... problems.
Uh-huh.
That's not a good idea, but it just shows I must have had a pretty strong constitution.
Mm-hmm.
I also found that I was relatively fearless in combat, which you never know until you go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds macho, but I enjoyed flying in combat and getting shot at.
Did that surprise you that you were?
Well, I had no idea. I didn't know how it was going to go.
Right.
I had never really been frightened of anything in my life. I'd always had, a captain of a football team.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, but I mean, it was just, you know, I had good training. Mm-hmm. So I only applied my training to what I knew. But then when it came time to, you know, get shot at, I walked right into it. And it just was, seemed relatively okay to me. Mm-hmm.
Did that surprise you about yourself?
I don't know. To be honest with you, I, not knowing what was going to happen,
right.
And it went right, is good. If it had gone bad, I probably would, I'd know a lot about it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What else have you learned? Or did you
learn? I learned how to be a commander, mm-hmm. in the sense of, you just look the other way for a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
and you accept a lot of things in other people, and you respect a lot of things in other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an excellent relationship with my flyers,
mm-hmm.
and then another excellent relationship with my enlisted men. As goes the fact that we still meet every year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no. I guess that's about it. Well, I learned I could stay away from home for a year, but I wasn't too happy about that.
Mm-hmm. How did your wife do during the war?
Her mother died while she was in. While I was over there, and that was a kind of a tough break for her.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad died while I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
So she was surrounded. She's a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
So she was surrounded by two kids. They're about 11 months apart. They're almost like twins.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in there. They were about 6-7 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, she had her hands full. Never griped. She never griped. I never heard a bad word. I never heard a bad word when I got home. Very fortunate there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What other lessons do you think the United States did or did not learn? You mentioned about the body count, but you didn't expand on that.
Oh, that was terrible. Somebody was lying there through their teeth. And there's no sense in doing that because either, first of all, the media has to be in cahoots with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, the government is lying to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, over in the Afghanistan or wherever, we lose one or two. They tell about it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking 125 or more every week, they're going to start running to hide. Because they're scattered all over the country. Nobody will ever know. They don't count.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was. I almost wrote a letter to the editor to the New York Star Ledger about that. I thought, if I do that, I'm just going to stir up a pot that I can't cover up. And I won't be able to stay here to fight it. So I'll go back to the country and that'll be it.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do anything about it.
So, do you distrust the government?
Well, as far as, lying to the public, sure. Why not?
Well, do you think, I'm interested because you were talking about the fact that you feel like there's been no side effects too much from the Agent Orange exposure, and the government told you that, you know, it was safe for you to be around and spray and use.
Then they did.
But what do you think now? Do you think the government was maybe not telling you the whole truth?
Well, after 20 something, when did we start? 80, 22 years of Air Force steady physicals. You know, we've been going to California,
mm-hmm.
to Scripps Howard, and getting these completely honest physicals.
Mm-hmm.
And the best that we can come up with, and them too, and they're not. They have no reason to lie that I know of.
This is the Air Force. This is government, right?
No, this is Scripps Howard.
Okay.
That's a civilian organization.
Okay.
They do the physicals. The Air Force releases the data, but while we're there, we're talking to them all the time. We know what's going on,
mm-hmm.
and they know what's going on. And they have suspected diabetes. Nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, the carcinogenic something or other. None of us seem to have it, but
mm-hmm.
carcinogenics? I don't know. Funny word. Something.
Carcinogen?
Yeah, yeah.
Carcinogen exposure?
I hear that a lot. But I even donated, and a lot of us did, fat samples,
mm-hmm.
to see if our dioxin levels were high.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our enlisted guys were. Remember now, they were in the back of the airplane. They took the brunt of a spraying tank that was sprayed up, shot open.
Mm-hmm.
So, but... We're all still floating around. Not too many of us have died.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been a. In fact, the results at one point, you know, we're matched against a control.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's are we the control? Well, anyway, we're matched against a another person, similar in as many ways as possible to ourselves. Air Force pilot, time, flew the same kind of airplanes,
mm-hmm.
but never was exposed to Agent Orange. And we have turned out to be slightly healthier than they are.
Hmm.
So,
well,
because they follow them exactly, you know, as they do us.
Uh-huh.
And they intermingle us when we're out there going through the thing. Except that when we go out of sea flight, there ain't no question about who we were. You know, they're wearing their hats. You know, we're not supposed to tell the docs that have seen us if we were ranch hands or for civilian or non-ranch hands.
Mm-hmm.
Here comes Sea Flight, you know, Christ, T-shirts and hats and all the crap, blue scarves, purple scarves, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So, we don't skew the results, I'm sure.
Okay. Okay. You mentioned, we talked about the media coverage of the war and how you thought that was, you know, pretty poor.
Poor is right.
Right.
Yeah.
What about the way that Hollywood has portrayed the Vietnam War in movies?
What a heroic bunch of mothers, huh? I never was a grunt, although I went through jump school.
Mm-hmm.
And I have 107 jumps, and I've jumped with the SEAL teams and all the rest of them. But I've never been out and roaming around in the Ranger camp or in the SEAL business.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't honestly say, you know, that maybe these guys did live like that. I don't know. But when they get to the Air Force part of it, bull. They're having trouble. You notice there's not too many things on the Air Force out about the war.
That's right.
Yeah, because they don't have no way of putting it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I don't think much of it happened there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think the public is misinformed about the Vietnam War?
Oh, I think they were when it was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the public cares much one way or the other about it right now. Doesn't seem to be much of a. I think they're more concerned about Iraq.
If you were to address a group of young people today about the Vietnam War, what would you tell them?
Just about everything I've told you. That we killed 58,000 youngsters unnecessarily. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't feel like we did not follow our own intentions. In fact, we gave up. We literally lost the war. That's all I can say, I guess. How else to say it?
So you do feel like we lost that war?
Well, obviously. Now, we made the North Vietnamese the fifth largest air force in the world.
Mm-hmm.
All the choppers and fighters and everything else they took over.
Mm-hmm.
Tanks, my gosh. Yeah, they became the fifth biggest armed nation in the world.
Looking back, what do you think the United States was trying to accomplish there in Vietnam?
Well, you know, probably, again, it's above my pay scale, but I would say that they probably thought the domino theory was valid,
mm-hmm.
and that if they didn't stop communism there,
mm-hmm.
it would continue to infect the rest of the Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they really had a valid outlook on it and thought process.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't prosecute it, that's all. There's a good word. I like that. I'm going to use that.
Okay.
Yeah. I think they prosecuted the war poorly. How's that?
Okay. Did you, at the time, believe in the domino theory?
Well, I don't know. I wasn't that much of a world... I just wanted to go fight a war.
Right.
I know that sounds kind of naive, but if they said there's a domino theory, okay, go ahead, whatever it is, we'll start the war. Let me get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I wasn't big on that stuff in those days.
Charlie, have you visited the Vietnam Memorial in Washington D.C.?
One time, and it broke my heart. I would never go again.
Why is that?
First of all, I think the monument itself. The wall is a disgrace. It's black, it's in a hole, and it should be white, and it should be up above the ground.
Okay.
And then, nextly, all the folks, the 28 that I lost over there are on that wall. Mm-hmm. So, but I just like the wall, obviously, as an edifice or a monument or something, whatever you want to call it. Bummer.
What was it? An emotional experience for you?
Oh God, yes.
Okay.
Oh, boy. It really ripped me up, and I just wheeled about and headed right out. Remember, I was right there in Washington. I could go to it in five minutes, any time, for those 3 years I was working there. Mm-hmm.
Why just one time?
I don't know. Somehow or another, I knew it was going to hurt me, and I knew I wasn't going to like it. Mm-hmm. So I gritted my teeth and tried it, and boy, everything I thought was right. Mm-hmm. It was there. I really am disappointed with the wall itself. That thing is like a tomb, and that's what it makes it look like anyway.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the Vietnam War has most affected your life?
It got me promoted. I got a lot of medals. Mm-hmm. That looked good in my uniform. Other than that, like any other guy that's been in combat, mm-hmm. I can hold my own, you know, chatting, talking. And it's a good feeling in that sense, mm-hmm. to know you've been to war and you're back home. Mm-hmm. When you get amongst others that have been there and done that, you can just mix right in with them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think it changed me much. It didn't change me family-wise. Mm-hmm. And it didn't change me political affiliation-wise. Mm-hmm. Certainly didn't endear me to the media, and didn't endear me to my own government, as far as that goes for it. Mm-hmm. But those folks are all gone. They're not there anymore.
Right.
McNamara, that foolish man, is gone. Oh, sorry, 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 Secretary of State.
What did you think when he went back to Hanoi in 1995 and tried to kind of reconcile his role in the war and talk about, you know...
Politico BS. No interest in it whatsoever.
Hmm. So when you came back, you were in Washington, you said, for 3 years. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. And from Washington, well, what was your duty in Washington?
I was in charge of life support for a program, or what do you call it? Chief of life support for all the stuff that we build up and do what for Air Force.
Okay.
Ejection seats and rafts and helmets and... dozens and thousands of pieces of equipment, yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a good job. I enjoyed it.
Did you make a lieutenant colonel in Washington?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had there was a brigadier general who came in from Tuck Lee. Mm-hmm. He had a thud wing. And Willie Chiersell. What a nice man. And he came to his first briefing. I was in Systems Command, mm-hmm. and Systems Command headquarters, and quite a few generals in that building. Mm-hmm. And here comes one star, new Willie Chiersell, and he has a meeting, and I have to go. It's a command performance. I'm standing in the back of the room, and Willie's up there, and he gets briefed on Minutemen missiles and all the things that are going on, wonderful things. And I see him look over at me a couple of times, and kind of winding down. I see him look at him, give me a little, come over here when you get a chance, you know, type thing. Mm-hmm. So when it was over, I went over and I said to him, hi. He said, you've been Vietnam, boy. I said, yes, sir. He said, you sure got a chest full of medals. I said, so do you, sir. He said, what do you think of that briefing they just gave me? I never batted an eye. I said, they're full of shit. I said, they blew it right in your ear. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, by God, I like the way you talk. And at the time now, I was a brand new major or something. I don't know if I was that. I might have still been a captain. No, I was a major when I was in Vietnam. So anyway, next day I went to work, I had a yellow telephone on my desk. And my boss didn't have a yellow telephone. And his boss didn't have a yellow telephone, but I had a yellow telephone. So every time Willie would have something come up, and we'd have a staff meeting, he'd call me up later and say, what do you think? I'd say, well, this guy was pretty straight. This guy was a pain. He just it to you. And, you know, he said, thanks. You got the same thoughts I have. Mm-hmm. And 2 years later, I was a lieutenant colonel, regular officer, and a pick of my assignment anywhere.
Where did you go?
Eglin. Mm-hmm. Where he went.
Yeah.
But he retired. Yeah. I would have made Bert colonel if he had stayed in service. Yeah. He was a good man.
How long were you at Eglin?
Just 2 years, and then we got a unit moved to Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. And then I spent that next couple of years out there waiting to retire. And I retired with 26.
Right.
Came right back to the East Coast, right back to Washington.
Uh-huh.
And went to work for the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board.
Mm-hmm.
I was the dean of the Accident Investigation School for 1 year, went over to the GO team, and spent the rest of my 4 or 5 years or six, whatever it was, as a ops group chairman, GO team,
mm-hmm.
which was a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But then I wanted to fly some more. So I quit them. Didn't take the retirement. Just took the money. And I went with the U.S. Department of Agriculture as chief of international air operations. And that meant I had to go to Mexico
mm-hmm.
and work down there for about 3 years. But it was fly down Monday, fly home Friday. I had something like 800,000 frequent flyer miles
mm-hmm.
by the time I quit that job. Mm-hmm. And I quit it, too, because I couldn't stand the bribery that was going on in that operation. Our State Department's bummers. They are really bad.
Why do you say that?
Oh, bribing, bribe. I wouldn't bribe, so they sent a guy down with a black bag, and he walked around behind me and did all the bribing.
Hmm.
And that's what that really turned me off.
What were they bribing for?
Oh, everything you're doing in Mexico, you got to bribe.
Hmm. Why did you decide to get out after 26 years?
Looking back, I wish I'd gotten out at 20.
Really?
Only because of the, if I could have gone right to the NTSB. Boy, that was a good job. I liked that job.
Mm-hmm.
I know it sounds bad, but I was doing accident investigation in the Air Force. So it was no change for me.
Mm-hmm.
A hell of a big pay raise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, 26 was the year to get out. There's a whole bunch of things that came together right then and there.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, they pumped up all the retirement, what the hell do you call them, end of the year, cost of living yeah,
mm-hmm.
Things. They went up to 9% in the Carter years. And, of course, I got out. My retirement day, when I got out, almost doubled in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
It was really amazing because of the COLAs that were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, another guy sat down there with his calculator and figured it all out. He said, 26, time to get out.
Okay.
And a whole bunch of us got out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are the guys that pushed the big figures around. Look at it. So I wasn't through any great thing. It's just that, I guess there is one thing. I was flying, I was attached to the test pilot school
mm-hmm.
at Edwards Air Force Base as an instructor pilot
mm-hmm.
to get my flying time. And when the F-15, the F-16 came out, they would allow me to chase them and with a photo made, let him picture them, show mm-hmm. pictures of them. They wouldn't let me fly them. And I said, why not? And they said, because you're not going to be flying after you turn 45. And I said, you got to be kidding. I'm just getting the hang of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no. And at age 45, they shut me off. And within a month, I was out of service.
Hmm. Was that a standard age limit?
I don't know. I know that was for me.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I know.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of guys have flown later than that, but they probably were wing commanders or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could you comment on the role of the Air Force in the military today?
Well, I like our... I like the airplanes they're flying.
Mm-hmm.
The 15 and 16. And the A-10, for the job it's got to do, is a good airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And this F-22 just looks like it's going to replace be a better replacement than the one it's replacing. What am I trying to say? It's going to be a hell of a big airplane, good airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's encouraging. I know that the chiefs and the super chiefs are having a hell of a time with their enlisted guys. So.
What do you mean?
Oh, the guys can tell them to go kiss their butt. You know, today, nothing happens. They don't have any power. It used to be a sergeant in the Air Force was, a sergeant in any service,
mm-hmah.
was God to the younger troops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, today he's not. So we've become very, very.
The discipline has changed.
Yeah, has it ever.
What about the role of the Air Force and air power in warfare? How has that changed a lot since the Vietnam War, in your opinion?
Well, I think now we're the primary doer.
Mm-hmm.
You still got to have somebody walking down. You can't. I never take that away from the military, mm-hmm. but the Army. But the Air Force is the way to go right now. You can go in dark at night. Nobody sees you. Blow up whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Stand offshore in the Navy. I can drop harpoons or tomahawks or whatever they're throwing.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. And what else? We got Marines. Marines can go anywhere, and they do anything. And they are something else, too.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're in good shape. I like it.
Do you think it's... how different is it, in your opinion, from...
Well, we were pretty diversified before, but we're working together a lot better now. You know, am I saying that right?
Yeah, there's better cooperation.
Cooperation.
The branches.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so there was less cooperation between the branches in Vietnam in that era versus today?
That's the only thing I ever dealt with was the Air Force.
Okay.
Though I did get top cover from the Navy. But usually we couldn't talk to them. Different channels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that works.
Okay. Charlie, is there anything else you want to add to our conversation today?
Nope, nothing. I'm happy.
Okay. Well, very good. We appreciate.
Sorry, I beat your ears, but.
No. I appreciate your time very much, and we'll stop the interview now.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Are we going to call tomorrow or not?